Communication from the Chair.
Honourable members, yesterday the Honourable Roy Clinton formally signified to me his intention to step down as leader of the opposition. In a parliamentary democracy such as ours, it is the long established convention that the post of leader of the opposition is held by that elected member of the opposition who commands majority support from his elected colleagues sitting on the opposition benches. I have also been formally notified in writing that the elected members of the GSC decided yesterday morning that the Honourable Elliot Phillips should, as from today, discharge the duty of the post of Leader of the Opposition. Accordingly, I now formally recognise him and congratulate him as such. Consequently, this Parliament will also now recognise the Honourable Member as the Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, thank you very much for that acknowledgement of the role of the Leader of the Opposition. Of course, I should comment from the start that the GSC has had a democratic vote insofar as the leadership of the party is concerned, and returned the party with 65% of its members and 60% of a combined vote between the executive and the membership. Therefore, our view has it is and will currently be from now on that Mr. Al-Fadi will lead the GSC. However, I understand what Mr. Fieger has said in relation to prevention, practice, and everything else that concerns the role of leader of the opposition in this time. What I would say is this, Mr. Speaker, I do not have no concern as to who addresses me as what. What I want to do is get on with the job that I've been asked to do and hopefully do it as well as I can to the best of my ability.
Or the Chief Minister?
Well, Mr. Speaker, it's my pleasure to get up to congratulate the Honourable Mr. Phillips for being recognised as leader of the opposition, and therefore as leader of the GSD in this House, and to thank Mr. Clinton for the way that he discharged his obligations as leader of the opposition in the short time that he did so. I think we enjoyed a combative on-stage and convivial off-stage relationship, which I hope for our will be able to emulate with Mr. Phillips. Mr. Speaker, Bob Felisa had one. Joshua Hassan had four. You had one. Joe Bolsano had two. Peter Barrana had two. And I've got four, Mr. Speaker. Three in just 1 year. A leader of the opposition, that is. So it's a pleasure to see that we're going to have now the opportunity to cross political swords. What we are referred to in the context of this Parliament is important in the context of our parliamentary democracy. We have a system of laws which requires us to refer to each other in a particular way. And honourable members of a thought to grab standing orders when they think that we are imputing their motives or otherwise breaching the rules. So we will not do so. We will recognise the Honourable Mr. Phillips as the leader of the opposition in this Parliament and outside it, insofar as parliamentary procedures are concerned.
Petitions, announcements, papers to be laid, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Speaker, the honour to lay on the table, the orders of the Council of the Gibraltar Regulatory Authority for the year end of the 31st of March 2017.
Order to love. Report of committee. Answers to oral questions. We commence with question number 697, the Honourable T.M. Hammond. That's the thing he made it.
Mr. Speaker, what measures have been introduced since January 2016, and I quote, to make the pedestrian experience a safe and pleasurable one?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, there have been numerous pedestrian enhancements since January 2016.
Ford News Media Crossings have been installed in several areas throughout Gibraltar, namely on Rosa Road by Bayview Shelters, the Oka Road by Shawfront Farm Estates, Newport Avenue at the entrance to the hospital, and by Midtown Coach and Car Park on Reformation Road. In addition to these Rosa crossings, we have also installed a much-needed light control crossing by Ocean View Facility on Europa Road to facilitate the users and visitors of the centre alike. Following on from the highly successful countdown timer situated at the traffic light crossing at the Lionwood Road junction by City Hall, we announced in July this year the installation of two new countdown timers to the light control crossings in the area of Waterford Road, one by the eastern side of the Water Gardens complex and the other at Kingsley Junction with Waterford Roundabout. Further enhancements to existing light control crossings are planned to be rolled out at other crossings throughout the road. With regards to improving pedestrian safety and encouraging walking, several schemes have been rolled out, which include the following. A new pavement along Gardner Street and the beautification and pedestrianisation of Wellington Front. Main Street and Irishman delivery times and restrictions have also been implemented successfully to limit the amount of vehicles entering and conflicting with the main western zone. In addition to this, three new commercial loading and unloading zones have been created at Fifth Market Road, John Matthew Square and Main Street South. These loading and unloading commercial zones have effectively and profitably segregated commercial vehicles from the main pedestrian thoroughfare, thus making Main Street and I found a safer environment for the general public to enjoy. New pedestrian walking sign improvements have recently been installed by Waterport Road from the Waterport Roundabout to the Cruise Terminal. These improvements form part of sustainable travel initiatives to promote walking and accessibility around Gibraltar, which builds on already installed signage by the area by Midtown Car Park and City Centre directly signage by Waterport Road, Reformation Road and by Coral Road. Walking time signs will also in due course be implemented at key locations showing approximate route times, which will aim to enhance and encourage walking and at the same time highlighting differences to key destinations to pedestrians that are unfamiliar with their surrounding areas.
When you add them up, relatively minor things in terms of improving the pedestrian experience. My experience in general walking around Gibraltar, Main Street accepted, because it isn't pedestrianised, and obviously the majority of Gibraltar isn't pedestrianised, and therefore it is noisy, often polluted walk, pavements are usually uneven and difficult to navigate also, particularly in the area of the frontier, around Queensway, Rosa Road, in fact, many of the areas where otherwise it would and should be a rather pleasant experience to walk, and the conditions at present do not encourage people to walk. Did the government have a program in place to improve pavement surfaces, to make them more easy to navigate, and are there any plans to pedestrianise other areas, in order again to enhance that pedestrian experience?
The decision very much depends on which side of the house you're on, because in my mind there's been vast amounts of improvement in terms of pedestrian safety and comfort. Obviously, you look at the other side, and then we look at things from the other side and try to find, you know, where the potholes are, where the missing families are. That is part of the game we play here. But I think no one can deny the fact that vast improvements have been made, and the government continues. That's recently happened with Gardner Street, an area where there's literally never been a pavement, an area where you'd walk out of a business, walk out of an establishment, and find yourself right on the road. Certain places around the road are impossible, and to make, you know, more narrow roads, make them safer in that respect. So every effort is the opportunity possible is taken to make the pedestrian experience safer. We also look very carefully areas where there's and vehicles constantly obstructing, for example, the obstruction to pedestrian access on pavement, for example, when cars are parked on pavement, we make sure that these cars are removed or fined or taken care of in that respect. So, and as part of general highways maintenance, highways is constantly looking at improving
it comes to accessibility. You look at drop curves, you look at the studies specific before you get to the crossing to ensure that people with disabilities are also able to enjoy the public footpath. But as part of the sustainable traffic and transport plan, clearly we want to encourage people to walk, we want people to adopt that form of transport, so to speak, and in second to the motorized vehicle, and every effort will be made to make it feel better, as we have seen as well in Main Street, whereby the filling of the tires eventually has also made that a much better and more comfortable thing to do for people, especially for persons wearing high heels. And that's something which has been most carried out, I think it's called a remain, that's another important improvement. And we will, as part of the plan, we will, as the initial question did specify, the next phase that we hope to find distances, so people are aware that town centre is only a mere 5 minute walk, and probably will take you a lot longer to find the parking if that's what you find to do.
Mr. Speaker, I just want to point out, I don't know if you're looking for potholes, they tend to find me, because there are so many of them, people just happen to stumble into them. Just on the point of you did raise Main Street, Minister, and you mentioned the cobbles being filled in there. That cobble's been complete, and my understanding is that there are still areas of Main Street which have not been filled.
Because that project in fact should be close to completion now, and the vast area has already been carried out. It's been done over a number of two times a year. And now I think, again, I have mentioned the project, and people, obviously, I think there's a little bit of work left to do, but in Maine, the main thing is almost ready. Obviously, it's not ready very closely.
Question number 698, the Honourable PM Hughes.
Mr. Speaker, having conducted a small survey with approximately 20 respondents, 90% of them indicated that their vehicles did not undergo emissions testing during the routine. Can the Minister say why testing is not being conducted despite this being a legal requirement, and how he reconciles this failure with government's commitment to improving air quality?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, in order to answer this question accurately, it would be useful to see how the survey was conducted and how the questions were defined, for example, the class, type, and propulsion of vehicles, and the date on which those vehicles were tested at the vehicle test centre. This is because, under our legislation, certain vehicles, for example, vehicles registered or put into service before the 1st January 1980, are exempted from their passenger tests, or it may have been the case that a vehicle emission analyzer may have been sent to Madrid to undergo major repairs or calibration due to the fact that calibration equipment is a requirement for emission testing. Therefore, without approximate date, it is difficult to give you an accurate answer. Notwithstanding, if it were the case that the gas analyzers were out of action and as specified in our legislation, when this equipment is out of service, vehicle testers undertake vehicle inspection tests in order to ascertain if vehicles have leaks which could affect emission measurements.
A visual analysis on that to give an indication as to whether the catalytic converter is working, whether what level of emissions, whether there is a tolerable level of emissions. It's just quite impossible to tell in that respect. I can tell the minister that my own two vehicles were a motorbike, a moped 125, and a saloon car. Both underwent MOT tests this year. Neither was tested, and that seems to be the general response when people are asked is that not good. I understand if the equipment isn't serviceable, that would be unfortunate, but there isn't going to come in as a proper way of measuring, and the vehicles may get through the nets that way, but certainly it would appear to me that that wouldn't account for the volume of vehicles which are not undergoing proper emission testing. And of course, this is very important, because it does directly affect the quality of the air we breathe, and particularly as pedestrians will be walking around alongside a highway and breathing on the street. So it is very important that vehicles are tested. Therefore, I would ask the Minister to look at the one thing we've done in that respect, to see how tests are conducted, to understand how frequently these emissions testing machines are observed, well, if that is the case. And certainly for the legislation to be applied to ensure that our air quality is as good as it can be with respect to emissions from vehicles.
Mr. Speaker, I mean, a survey of 20 vehicles of which two were young and one was in service, you know, I just need to have a little bit of not a very big sample. I mean, it's very unfair to say that, you know, the tests have been not happening for a long period of time. Yeah, and I think we agree that, of course, it's time on to ask, and it should increase the benefits to those people who didn't pay and to work. Now, the cabinet conversely has said, because I don't have an exact data, I can't really say whether it was a result of, you know, at least a piece of equipment which is, you know, has been down or otherwise. So, in fact, recently there was a situation whereby the testers were down, the test equipment was down, and actually spoke about the opportunity to sort water and sound at the actual MOT venue, and the wind blows also very windy environment to get into the system, and they need to be serviced more readily than expected. So that can happen, there can be a few of that, and I think there was a few late with that. I think both of the arrivals were done, but then we just got energy to be able to afford and everything like the best thing that can be done. And the second thing, besides a vision inspection, and the only one I've already said, you know, it there is to caught up in the next one, but there will be more that can be done in that respect.
Being raised directly with me by a number of young people, in fact, who have not clearly taken part in this survey that my honourable friend has conducted. But what I would say, given the fact that the government committed to the environment, and certainly Dr. Cortez has said to us on a number of occasions in relation to make submissions in relation to improving air quality, I entirely agree with the government's position with improving air quality. Should we not encourage those that are working in relevant departments to ensure that this legal requirement is conducted? Because the information that I receive from young members of the public who are interested in the environment and interested in air quality and improving it, that they should be given that reassurance that the government is doing everything it can to improve the air quality of our community.
And with this speaker, this is what can be done, you know, is done. The issue is that I don't have the date in particular. I don't know whether this, you know, 18 or 20 type of survey, whether these are the ones that you've got well within your membership or not. But if there is a moment in time when the equipment you use is down, when you can service in Madrid, in the same way, regularly, if everything has broken down and there's none available of the two that I think that we have an application, then obviously, that's what you find by servicing happened or repairs happen, so you really can do. And the other thing is, actually looking at your department, because we're supposed to be a surgery to be sure to be sure to be sure. But again, you could have certain levels and ready to go around. It's a bad environment, low seawater, a lot of sand, a lot of wind, and they're very sensitive to the equipment. These passes get into the system and make the system fail. And once they fail, they can't obviously that they're going to write after the guys going to the ferry, going to be repaired. So I think it's been an unfortunate event that has happened, because again, this is not something that's been a complete thing to happen or coming first, so they don't really want to be interested. And as I said, I can't specifically say in a lot of time range whether it was to be with that or what happened.
Question number 699, the Honourable PM Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, has government made any progress regarding the placement of no idling signs in key areas around the water, and does it envisage introducing legislation accordingly?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, yes, no idling signs have been installed before approaching the runway in both northern and southern approaches. There are no imminent plans for introducing legislation at present, but this option is still a possibility.
Question number 700, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, further to question 101 of 2017 and question 227 of 2017, can the government advise that it has made a decision in respect of the one expression of interest received for the leasing of its vehicle fleet? And if so, what are the financial terms agreed?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the answer remains. I set out the question 101 of 2017. Mr. Speaker, I regret the Minister's indicate to the House whether, given that the tender, I believe, was in December 2016, whether the government now has abandoned the idea of leasing the vehicle fleet, seeing as we are now, obviously, in December 2017.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman and I are still in the views in respect of this on a number of occasions. In fact, I think you recall that when the tender came out, the other gentleman said something about the government obviously being desperate to sell every asset it had to raise money, and including its vehicle fleet. So, if nothing else could be later, he was wrong about that. But the government is considering the best possible options for the taxpayer. Making that determination is not an easy one because it's a fairly large fleet that we have. So it's not that we've abandoned the idea, but it's not something that can move very quickly. It's not like it's something that the government needs to see move very quickly, but it's an idea that is being analysed in great detail.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know to the frequency of his intervention. If I ask him, what is the main consideration? Obviously, that is a minor factor, must be a top of the list. But is there anything in particular in respect of the original tender that is causing the government to consider it for over a year now? Or a year, let's say.
And what are you seeing, Mr. Speaker? Not just the numbers of the opposition in 1 year, but I think I've also worked out once I was sitting down that there are now more members of the DSP in this parliament who have been leader of the opposition than those who have not been. So, Mr. Hayes and Mr. Hammond, who have for 2 years to have a crack at the whip, but that aside, but Mr. Speaker, the issue is value for money. Making the assessment is not easy because we have such a difficult fleet that while in respect of some vehicles in the fleet, the leasing option may be a good one, when you start to get into the types of vehicles that we have, it's not always clear that when you bring the whole fleet together, the math stacks up on the basis of the fleet better value for money. And so therefore, that is an exercise that has to be done in very great detail. To give the Honourable Gentleman some idea of the issue, if you're dealing with a vehicle like a vehicle for conveying VIP, that's going to be quite a long shelf life, it's going to be easy to look after that vehicle, and so changing that vehicle every 3 years, which is the sort of thing that fleet option gives you, doesn't necessarily deliver the best value for money, depending on how that lease is structured and what you pay for the lease of that vehicle. When you're dealing with a refuse vehicle, then the turnover there might be slightly different, but the vehicle is also a more expensive vehicle to secure. You can extend the shelf life of that vehicle with very able mechanics, and the government has very able mechanical abilities at its disposal, either in-house or bought in. So doing the exercise of what we expect the vehicle to give us in terms of shelf life, and the replacement of that vehicle, which then needs to work for whoever is extending the lease deal to us, they need to have something which is not just a wreck at the end of it, and to be able to realize the value of that vehicle as well, it's not an easy exercise, and that's what's taking time to determine. Now, we could simply say this is too difficult, but we'll stop trying to do the exercise. But if the final conclusion of the exercise, we could talk about this for money for the taxpayer, then we should not turn our back on such an exercise simply because it is potentially harder to reach the conclusion that we might have wished or wanted that to be the case. But we can rest assured that there's no urgency in me
including the hot of the government speaker, therefore, he might have, in a moment of madness, tweeted a year ago, and so the exercise is an ongoing one. It may be that it comes to a conclusion which sees no further action taken, or it means the main thing comes to a conclusion that sees a cut on the proposal system.
Question number 701, the Honourable Alex Young.
Mr. Speaker, further to question 450, 2017, can the government provide an updated schedule together with A, the number of FCM sales fees, the number of FCM funding payments, and C, the number of FCM taxes together with the region's one?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
The information requested by the Honourable Member is detailed in the schedule that I will now hand over. No FCMs are cancelled as the speeding offences are captured by the static speed cameras are vetted by the RGP before they go to the next stage in the procedure, which is the issuing of NIP, Notice of Intended Prosecution. The RGP will filter out all foreign registered vehicles, emergency service vehicles, and front-facing motorbikes. They will also remove from the system offenders for speeding over 100 km per hour, as they will go to them directly and arrest them for dangerous driving.
Question number 702, the Honourable Alex Young.
The Speaker, further to question 589, 2017, can the government provide an updated schedule including A, location vehicle with further frequency, place and time the vehicle with further weight, see whether the parking restrictions were in place of fuel containers or other things?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
The piece of information requested by the Honourable Member is detailed in the schedule that I will now hand over.
Question number 703, the Honourable Alex Yanni.
Mr. Speaker, since December 2011, can the government provide details of cases where the technical services department has reported or objected to regarding the development of private parking lots and garages being constructed, which have resulted in lack of public parking spaces, including A, the date, B, number of parking, public parking lots, or potentially lots, C, number of private parking garages applied for, and be reasons why applications are supported or objected.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Infrastructure and Planning.
Mr. Speaker, the Technical Services Department is responsible to the Town Planning Department on all planning applications received by them. Technical Services comments on matters relating to civil engineering, highways, and sewage infrastructure. They do not, however, maintain a database of the comments that they provide to the Town Planning Department as this is beyond their remit. Since December 2011, there has been a total of 2,818 planning applications and 89 demolition applications, and it will therefore be an extremely laborious task to check through all the applications and comments to identify those instances where the department supported or objected an application regarding the creation of private parking spaces or garages. Technical Services has discussed the matter with Town Planning, who holds the repository for applications, and they too have confirmed that checking applications for that particular information being requested would require a manual search which would be laborious and time-consuming. Minutes of the GPC meeting, which this government made public and which are now online, may disclose some such information. The Honourable Gentleman had access to those minutes and can review them for himself. Notwithstanding the above, the Technical Services Department can confirm that, as a general rule, if the application involves the creation of more car parking spaces within the property guide than will be removed from the public highway, then the proposal will be supported on the basis that this will produce a net gain of parking. If the removal of one car parking on the public highway to create two or more within the property or spaces for. On a final point, while this is Technical Services' position on these matters, it is ultimately the Traffic Commission who have the authority on these matters, and they in turn also advise Town Planning on whether particular applications are approved or not.
figure. Going back to question 701, can I ask what the government is doing with regards to the unsaved FCMs, which seem to be quite prolific in some cases? There are more unsaved than saved.
We are going to discuss FPNs again. I think it would be useful for the general public who may be watching these proceedings to know that FPNs have fixed penalty notices.
Yes, in particular, right, unfortunately, it's become a question to before we move into the version of it in this case. Could I ask what the government is doing with regards to the unpaid fixed penalty notices? Going back from May, June, and July in particular, which are quite high months where the ratio is that there are more unpaid than paid fixed penalty notices.
And because the effort is made to follow up and get funding to pay for the FPN, there are circumstances whereby it is extremely difficult because the addresses for the particular vehicle in question may not be correct. And then, therefore, the NIC may arrive at the wrong address because the person has not changed their details, for example, or a story has occurred and the information is incorrect. And there are quite a few occasions where we struggle to find the person in question. And that is predominantly, I think, one of the main reasons why fines remain unpaid. But every effort is made to chase that. And these records, one of these two remain on file.
Mr. Speaker, just a supplemental question in relation to that. So it's a good question that the Honourable Member makes in relation to unpaid fines, because clearly, if you can't identify individuals within the system that should be paying these fines, you have an enormous expense of trying to locate them for one. And so you have hundreds of fines out there unpaid, which are unlikely to be paid because the system clearly hasn't been updated, including new addresses of individuals. So the government consider whether there needs to be a legal requirement imposed on individuals so that they have to update their details with relevant departments?
As far as I'm aware, there is a legal requirement on a very fixed paper vehicle should change the owner should buy some of the forms provided and the logbook, they should pass on the details to the department. If that does not happen, then obviously that is my issue, but it's obviously true to the required practice to be done. But clearly it is something which we look at as a department, because it is not acceptable that we have a question of displacing these people in that respect.
Just one other supplemental question. I agree, it must be extremely difficult, but we are looking at hundreds of fines there, where people should be really paying their dues when they come to you, insofar as the fines are concerned. It's very difficult if you're just relying on the sale of vehicles, maybe for data information, particularly when you can't locate individuals. It is likely, though, and I'm sure the Minister would agree, that these fines are likely to be undercoverable in the future.
Mr. Speaker, and it could be the case where fines could be unrecoverable. Every effort is made. But it is the obligation. When you pass a car, a fellow car on, you need to notify the department, and they should keep up the records for this particular reason. But obviously, there are moments where quite a few things where this is not possible. The department is looking at ways to improve this. This is something that has been the case for years and years, and we get that some of the living houses and some of it has been a factor for many years. But it is a legal obligation, and I think people are aware. And the forms, do state when you pass on a vehicle. And it does happen, in all fairness, when you sell a car, sometimes it's exactly the way that they're going. You sign your part of the form, and the person is going to sign their part of the form, and that doesn't happen. All that process is being looked at today.
Mr. Speaker, I apologise, one more. And clearly the example that my honourable friend is giving, the Minister, is in relation to when purchases sold and bought by individuals. But what happens in the case where one just simply has a vehicle for years and doesn't sell it, doesn't update their details? So clearly there's an entire historical backlog of fines that remain unpaid. And I appreciate that this may be something that we may have inherited from a previous administration, clearly in the context of that situation, so it must be something that the government can do to ensure that fines are paid.
Because the whole matter is being addressed, as the young woman rightly says, it's not just at the point of sale. I mean, people do move addresses, people do change addresses, and at every single MOC, in theory, that should be tied out, I mean, it should be a set of addresses. But it is very difficult because that happens both ways, that people remain the parent address. Even though they move the address, all that happens where the people remain in their old address, if it's somebody late then remains the address. And that is a problem. But as I said, the Barmouth Kitchen had all these issues because of FPN's disputing, it is something that has come to light even more so, like we said, because it's not a police problem, they're down stopping you, taking down the user. This is an automated system which takes further from the front, and then we start to see, you know, the government or the cities look and search for that the person who committed the offence. So as I said, the ground is looking at this and see how we can, you know, update these possible update the level of the government. It is an issue, and not just what we inherited, but you know, the people inherited themselves, it's something that has been a case for many, many years. But as a result of this new system of capturing automatically through machines, like a speed panel, that this, you know, is important that it's being highlighted even more so.
I think that if I may, I know you like us to quote the question. Is the minister fully satisfied that the best type of customer service relationship exists? Because I have spent in the last month having to help a particular constituent who received a 6-penalty notice issued in his name to the proper address, claiming that there was an offence committed by registration number 7 and was identified as a vehicle with a particular colour. And this constituent came to him and said, the vehicle I own happens to be a motorbike, not a car as stated in this file. And the colour obviously is now totally relevant, and the location where the parking space is supposed to have taken place is nowhere near an area where he's present. In trying to help this individual, I picked up the phone and rang the officer, and I was told in a very courteous, not rude, but a very courteous manner, you know, for kind of that, you've got to come here to the office, put in the phone and sign it. And I really got message to the individual, and he said, I'm not going to take a day's leave to sort out what is an amusing dollar, because I have made, you know, this attempt to correct it. So I said, well, look, you know, it's up to you what you do. Within a month, he got another letter reminder. This time I went in person and said, look, you know you mean well, you are not the person named here, and it's only we can't deal with you. So the matter remains pending on his own. The individual feeling that he's going to receive a notice to make an appearance in court for failure to pay the fine, having to take a day's leave to appear there, to then find that the vehicle does not belong to him. A little bit of detective work, because you've also heard that it's more available to find out. It now appears that because one has the model of the car and the colour, we have found is a registration number, but a mistake made by the officers in the parking ticket of the letter at the end. Now, if this individual was able to do that in the later time, really later being paid, could somehow now that looking at the phone computer system saying that have you made any mistake and put an error instead of a B or a C? You know, it's all to do with customer relationships that may or may not have passed collectively to solve this problem. I'll tell you that in a minute.
Mr. Speaker, I have to thank the Overgender for his positive contribution. There is a cancellation process, and sometimes I have to suppress and compare that to what I've heard. I mean, that is maybe others. But if that NIC is sent to an agent and sent to a position erroneously, then it should be possible, you know, to be able to sort that without having to go there. But if that fails, you know, there is a process and the risk that there could be, you know, if the conversation is not carried out, there could be the situation whereby you could receive a letter or summons to go to court for that purpose. But I would for your contribution, and I would say, I don't know if specifically, somebody specifically, if you have a problem to discuss, and looking to look for strong redundancy. But it's I suppose it's something that can happen, can happen, it won't.
And the question is not really a concerning question that's been asked so far. Mr. Speaker, during the Minister's initial answer to question 701, you referenced the fact that the RVP has seen a number of vehicles before sending out these 6 penalty notices. I believe emergency services were one of those categories, but I think you also said forward facing motorbikes. And I just want a clarification as to, as opposed to a backward facing motorbike, is that left side of the motorbike? And I just a little bit of clarification. And is it the case, therefore, that motorbikes that are photographed by a speed camera in their forward facing aspect are not being fined or cannot be fined, or are they taken on a different mechanism?
Yeah, I think we've had this discussion before in Parliament. There are security, there are cameras at the moment, and there are four cameras completely in both directions. So what happens is, if a camera is, if a person is caught with a motorbike, forward facing, there's no number facing in the picture. Hence, at the moment, depending on the site, unless the motorbike is going at a range of high speed, which I mentioned before, then you go over, I think it's 100 kilometers per hour, whereby the people then look at doing the driving or for the second, and they will go for the individual in question by other means, by the fact that they visually recognize the person without having to use the number plate. There are few cameras that won't take rear facing pictures, and we are looking, in fact, we have already received equipment to really tackle that issue. Remember, when we brought out the speed cameras, it was a pilot study, something that was needed, it had never happened to go before, and we were placed in different locations, trying to maximize the use of these cameras as far as possible. And it's not possible to have a camera facing the person, it wouldn't be viable in that respect. Now we're looking at other methods whereby you can now start capturing vehicles from the rear or from the front. But the screening process does happen with the eyes, you have to look at the speed cameras without making sure that they're not in any situations, making sure that they are legitimate cameras offenders. They're not persons who can't be traced or are in any services, sending to a fire emergency or whatever. That's why there's a screening process.
Robin Flanagan prevailed with the matter arising from the failure to question 702.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Looking at the schedule 700 from question 702 2017, which relates to the following vehicles which have been towed away. So, Speaker, the majority of these vehicles have been towed away from clean campaigns and clean display parking areas. And I was wanted to ask the government if they will review the towing away of vehicles and obviously people have paid or have failed to display their vehicles in the appropriate place in a public paying display area. It would make sense that if they're going to have to be fined and clamped, then that they don't have to actually go in and search for the vehicles. The SPM is going to see what the daily rate of that. Of that ticket would be, would the government consider not having to remove the physical vehicles if they're not actually obstructing anything that can be avoided in terms of not having to throw them away and look at that policy so that the person does not receive a negative impact on the vehicle devoted?
Mr. Speaker, clearly the fine, whatever that may be, and we generally be more in the figure they would have had to pay if they had done exactly the end of the payment taking this same machine, regardless of whether it's within the limit of £25 or whether it's a stamp which guarantees the same or whether this is paid away. It is not, if you look at the schedule, there are vehicles towed away, but there's different circumstances, different reasons. If there's a clear obstruction to the highway, the towed away, it obstructs the cleaning campaign as well, and the company involved, myself cannot get round and do the cleaning, and this is saying whether to remove the vehicle or not, it is impossible to clean if the vehicle remains there. Just like generally there are complaints because with both sides of the coin. For those people who feel that the school bus is kind of worth to do it and they're being, kind of rightfully legally parking, so as long as they will actually use it to place a ticket in the window or a clamp on the car, you immobilize it, I can't use the parking. It remains out of use for me. And that happens a lot as well. And there are a lot of people who say, well, what do I do? Now, that happens very often in the residential parking scene, for example, where a vehicle is constantly offending, and the residents say, well, this car has not got there, this car has not got a permit. Then what's going to happen? I mean, we replace a train, I would try to control the step 11 in each other, and eventually, we need to stay the car away. So they have to change in the second time today. If you look at this as a service provider, it's not that any particular area has been covered with street more than others. There's a very clear idea that it's happening throughout the road set, and not necessarily just areas where we expect schools to be there.
Mr. Speaker, it's just to understand whether government has a particular policy or has implemented a policy or provided guidance to the companies that operate the tolling of vehicles, considering that back in May 16 we appear to have one vehicle tolled, July 16 one vehicle, and then we come to May 17 and it's something approximating 100 vehicles tolled, and that trend, although it could somewhat continue after that point. Has government actually given instructions for a missing corporatism in any way? Is this the only thing? Whether the government has given instructions for more vehicles to be towed away, or whether this is just happened organically in some way?
You know, the company responsible for providing this service, that operates the record themselves, and that's told, more, or whatever. What there are certain key dates, you look at the start where certain things have happened, which have led to an impact. Have led to an increase in the fines or toll set, and it could be, for example, when a residential parking scheme comes into effect, or when there's an area which is due for cleaning, and it's a big area. So it very much depends on the date and in question, but I do recall that around, for example, look at May, there is quite a few examples that have come from a cleaning campaign. Again, if the cleaning happens, generally happens once a month. If, for example, an area is being left dirty because cars are constantly parking in the same place, or the same cars are keep on offending, then obviously there's a need to clean it, because that, and it could be that they say that in that way. But then, what has been the case is the residential parking scheme, especially with the zone one, there has been an increase opportunities to that. And as we roll out the other residential parking schemes, that will happen. There's also then the legal grace. So you start off, you launch the scheme, legal grace, and then you have to start acting, because otherwise, if you're very lenient, then the scheme fails from the start. You can't perform the function that we expected to, and it's the detriment of all residents. So, this is obviously a tool that we have, it's the only way you can actually make the scheme a success, or just kind of bang by and it's not working. I feel like the company's responsibility is actually to entertain, to look, review, and see how they manage this for us.
Question number 704, the Honourable T.M. Cannon.
Mr. Speaker, Service Question 449 of 2015, 8 of 2016, 332 of 2016, the Minister speaks during the Appropriation Bill on 630 of 2016. Can the Minister provide an update on whether the technical specifications of the Field Treatment Plant is now understood, and when government might be in a position to award the contract?
I'm to the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. Discussions have commenced with the preferred bidder. But given, Mr. Speaker, the position of the former leader of the opposition that we should not comment publicly on contracts until the ink is dry in agreement, it would be inappropriate to say more at this stage.
Question number 705, The Honourable Ellis Yannis.
Mr. Speaker, what has happened to the urban renewal program announced on the 13th of June 2013?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, much has already been done in respect to urban renewal in the Upper Town and pursuit of the programme. Every member can see progress for themselves if they care to wander in our magnificent Upper Town, although there is undoubtedly much yet to do.
Does the Minister have a schedule of what has been done and what remains to be done?
No, sir.
Question number 706, the Honourable Ellis Yannis.
Mr. Speaker, is the government reviewing the Upper Rock entrance to the show? Can it reveal what changes will be made?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, yes, it is. The details will be provided in due course.
Question number 707, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
This education provides details in respect of all grants awarded during this current financial year, other than mandatory grants, to any students in respect of dance or performing arts courses, indicating that these courses to be followed in college will be in United Kingdom welfare, as well as indicating the qualification expected to be attained upon successful completion of said courses.
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, all of our students undertaking the dance and performing arts course this financial year have been awarded mandatory grants.
Mr. Speaker, may I say that mandatory grants being restricted to those who have completed a level or level equivalent type of education?
To pick a mandatory grant in the normal manner of mandatory grants, as opposed to the discretionary awards which are for those that maybe come into the course later on or haven't quite got the grades or I mean that's the difference, as the honourable members were aware.
So therefore, if you think that can I perhaps the wording in my question without asking special grants awarded. It could have been that the grant has been awarded but the course has not yet commenced. Is the Minister grant for carrying that, or maybe because of the way I put the answer, I'm giving him the benefit of the right? So.
Mr. Speaker, the team in the Department of Education have looked at students currently undergoing dance and performing arts courses and have checked against those who are actually undergoing it now, whether they're mandatory, and the answer is all of them are. Therefore, ones that are not, the answer is zero, which is the answer that I have given. If there is any specific course or any specific student that the honourable member is referring to, perhaps he could ask him separately, and I would be very happy to look into any particular case. But this is information that has been extracted from our database.
You see, I think perhaps it might be better on the stage for them to tell you if the Honourable Minister and myself need to have the Speaker's chair later, and then we can follow that if required.
Question number 708, the Honourable Ellis Yannis.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a schedule of the number of pupils in each class during each school year since September 2012, as prepared by the Department of Education in preparation for the commencement of each academic year, taking A, the year the class belongs to B, the school the class belongs to C, the number of children with special needs, C, the number of learning support systems, D, the number of teachers, F, any other staff allocated to each class?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
this week at question 8 to be were answered by me in reply to question 6 1 2 6 2017 as overall figures for schools. As I have explained previously, allocations can change on a daily basis and full numbers per class cannot be provided overall. This applies similarly to E and F, in fact, possibly more so.
The speaker, we always seem to stumble on this question. I find it hard to believe that the Department of Education would not have prepared a certain figure for each class and the number of pupils that should be as in each class. I understand there are things to structure, but I'm asking for class figures in order to know what the statistics are in all schools, and the overall figure will simply not suffice. Is the honourable member able to answer this question, albeit following this session via email, as he has done on other occasions?
The honourable member has raised a last very similar question repeatedly over the last few sessions, always with a slight difference in wording. I have asked them that. I was under the whole question that I have got through, because as I said before in my answer, there are subtle differences in the question. But I fail to see what the honourable member is getting to. And if he were to sit with me and tell me, look, this is my concern, and this is why I'm asking, then perhaps I would be able to assist. But we get asked for huge quantities of information on a regular basis, all very similar, when I have explained that the classrooms themselves have to be flexible, and particularly when we get to learning support assistance and special educational needs, where, as I've explained before, some children are assessed and they move on to the SEM group. And then perhaps issues are resolved and they move back, and it's very, very difficult to give this information. Either there's a specific problem that the honourable member wants to catch me out on, ask me point blank, and I will try and assist him in catching me out. But it's very difficult to get the information together in this way, time after time after time.
In the speaker, I'm not trying to get the honourable minister catching out on anything. Other than get the information, which I think is relevant, and well, it's relevant to concerns which parents come to me about class sizes. All I want to do is get a statistic in order to just feel and just lay out what the statistics are. And I don't think I'm asking for any information which is too difficult to compile, when the department would have compiled this information in preparation for each academic year. And obviously, I do have to squeeze the questions in order to get them through. I'm not getting the answers which I want. And it's not the answer that I want the minister to give me, I just want the answer of what the statistics are.
The honourable member is not getting the answer that he wants here in Parliament. I would suggest to him that he accept the invitation of the minister, go and see the minister and try to thrash the matter out, and then come back to Parliament if necessary. Next question.
Question number 709, the Honourable Ellis Young.
The speaker, can the government explain what construction works will be carried out besides schools whilst in use, and the estimated timeline of the same?
Answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The speaker, we answer this question together with questions 710 to 717.
Question number 710, the Honourable Ellis Young.
Can the government reveal what changes will current pupils be expected to adapt to from September 2017 until the new refurbished schools are delivered?
Question number 711, the Honourable Ellis Young.
Can the government reveal the estimated timeline for delivering each new or refurbished school?
Question number 712, the Honourable Ellis Young.
Mr. Speaker, has the government consulted the rest of the South Wales proposal on the new school?
Question number 713, the Honourable Ellis Yaman.
Mr. Speaker, has the government undertaken a traffic and transport impact assessment for the proposed new school?
Question number 714, the Honourable Ellis Yaman.
Mr. Speaker, how will the government conduct the population of the school for qualification of schools?
Question number 715, the Honourable Ms. Pindi Hassanal.
Can government give details of the proposed future for the Bayside and St. Martin's school sites once these have been vacated?
Question number 716, the Honourable Ms. Pindi Hassanal.
Will the existing schools that will be undergoing refurbishment be worked on while pupils are present in the schools?
Question number 717, the Honourable Ms. Pindi Hassanal.
Following last week, or actually a couple of weeks ago now, given the parliamentary postponing, following last week's attendance by the Chief Minister and Minister for Education at the general meeting held with teachers, can government confirm whether teachers are happy with the proposed new schools as well as with the plans for the schools that will be undergoing refurbishment?
And for the Honourable Minister for Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, construction of Notre Dame will be carried out next to the current Notre Dame, after which the dams will be built next to the new Notre Dame. Construction will be carried out in a timely manner, with as minimum disruption as possible, and plans are in place to achieve this. This will be done by September 2018 and 2019, respectively. Current pupils are just as important as they entered the system in 2019, and therefore their educational journey will not be compromised or affected in any way. In answer to question 711, Notre Dame School, 8:45 a.m. Monday, 3rd September 2018, the remainder, 8:45 a.m. Monday, 2nd September 2019. In answer to question 712, yes it has, Mr. Speaker. And in answer to question 713, the government is of course undertaking this. In answer to question 714, details of the options of how this is to be achieved are given in the published co-education report. In question, answer to question 715, expressions of interest have been invited for these sites. There will be occasions, Mr. Speaker, in relation to 716, when this is inevitable, although we clearly will keep disruption to a minimum and ensure in particular that teaching and examinations are not affected and that absolute safety is ensured. And in answer to question 717, Mr. Speaker, our guiding principle has to be whether the proposed changes will improve the education of future generations of children who will go on to become the citizens of tomorrow. We have carried out a wide consultation exercise, and every indication is that teachers and the general public at large are happy overall. With any major change process, there will always be diverging opinions, and I, of course, respect these.
Mr. Speaker, if I may interject from 713 as a supplementary, considering the transfer in such assessment, wouldn't it have been more practical to do this if you undertake this assessment before designs were put out? Because at this point, whatever result comes out is pretty limited anyway, considering that the schools are going ahead. So even if we get a very negative report, how can we change things anyway at this point?
Mr. Speaker, we are in a state where we can still make changes to the actual layout, particularly in those that are being designed now beyond the concept stage. Obviously, we're limited to the sites we have available in the world, and there will be a certain amount of adaptation, but I'm confident that if any major problem is identified, that we will be able to address these in the best manner possible.
Thank you.
Following up on 713,
from my understanding, the parking underground, the correct school, for example, is going to be closed off. Will the government be increasing public transport links to that area?
Speaker, this is one of the matters that will be assessed in time for the opening of the new school in September 2019.
And given, for example, Mr. Speaker, that we will now have two co-educational schools where 2,000 pupils will be in one location, and then we're going to have St. Paul and Mr. Van close together in a new location, this is going to come with its own impact in terms of transport and access. Is this not something that the government has already taken into account?
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, is what something that the government has already taken into account?
The access to these new schools.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, it's taken into account. We are now refining as to how we can ensure that there's only minimum adverse effects, if any at all.
In speaking of relationship 712, I did not catch whether the government has consulted with experts. However, the education minister has stated that the school that cater for over 2,000 pupils is undesirable, and therefore I would like the government to explain how they have concluded that two co-educational schools within the same campus is any better and of more benefit to the students.
It's difficult because they are two schools and not one.
Is there a model that has been the government has based this idea on, or is it a concept that this government has come up with?
Speaker, we have two comprehensive schools at the moment, but I am committed to that as opposed to the parties that the honourable member stood with, who wanted to convert into one, and we're being consistent because that is our policy, and that had the right support of the teaching professor at the time.
The minister has said that the party of this side, that is the team, wants to win the one. I disagree, I completely disagree with that. I think if we leave that out, then the minister and the honourable member can continue to question, but to bring it into the fact or with what is alleged as a fact, which I would then need to refuse, it's just wasting parliamentary time.
I understand that the minister is referring to the policy that was promulgated by the GSC, is that the correct position or isn't it?
Peter, the policy that was announced during the last general election was made it clear. The GSC was not a proponent of a mega school. The language that was used by the government. In respect of our policy, it's quite clear what we decided that we wanted to do. That was to create an option for co-education, and of course we were consulted with those stakeholders in relation to education. There was never the inclusion of one mega school. That's completely wrong. There is a TV debate that I had with the Honourable Neil Cox in relation to that very issue, and it was language which was used by the GSLP to denigrate the policy of the GSC in relation to the principle of co-education, which is this party has put forward the policy, and it is the government on the other side that is thought to copy the idea of co-education completely, and therefore we commend them, of course, for taking on board our ideas on co-education, of constituting a committee to allow to advise the government in relation to co-education, but of course we commend them for bringing forward a GSC policy.
So, we are not going to debate. The GSC policy is not going to be debated. We have a number of questions seeking information. Information is being provided by the government. I'm not allowing a debate on the educational policy either of the government or of the opposition at this stage. If you want to have a debate, I only put down a motion for the next meeting of the House. Perhaps it will be a very salutary thing to do, given the announcements which the government has made. I invite you to do that.
Mr. Speaker, I think it is absolutely right that we should not have a debate on GSC policy, because first of all, we're dealing with an individual who is no longer in the GSC. Although he stood with the GSC, and the issues that were being put to him were the things that were in the GSC manifesto. But I think actually we're debating PDP policy, because I think the first to propose co-education for the PDP, yes, I recognise it was an effect of one newspaper this morning called a takeover of the GSC by the PDP, so I'd be delighted to pursue the issue there. But let's be very clear, Mr. Speaker, in our manifesto,
and especially with people selected at the last election by a ratio of 2-1, there was a commitment to look at higher education in the way that we have done. So, Mr. Speaker, the only issue that really falls to be considered is whether or not, I think being explored by Mr. Yamas, which I wish to give him comfort on from here, as the Honourable Minister has done, whether we're looking at a mega school or we're looking at two schools. Now, the policy that he defended at the general election was to have one comprehensive. You cannot have anything other than co-education, Mr. Speaker, if you only have one comprehensive, whatever consultation you may do. I guess you have one comprehensive with classes just for boys or classes just for girls. And I think also agree with the colleagues. We are not going down the route of one institution. We're going down the route of two institutions, two separate institutions. Now, whether honourable members want to get into a tug of war with the building and say, right, if those two buildings are 500 metres apart, then I'm satisfied with two schools. If they're half a mile apart, they're definitely two schools. If they're 450 metres apart, then I'm going to call it one school, even if it's two schools. I think it's the other general, and that is what they're going to get into if they start looking at the geography of the city. You have two institutions here. They are close to each other, and they share one area, which is the library. And there's a simple reason for that, Mr. Speaker, in terms of the resources of this community. Do you put cash into building two libraries? Let's just say for the purposes of this argument, you put £100,000 into building the library, and you then put £200,000 into acquiring books for each of the libraries? Or do you put one set of building costs in and have double the resources available to purchase books for the boys and girls who are going to be in the institution? Well, that's what we've been consulting on, that's what we've been working on, that's what we think produces the best result, and it's a better result than the mega school. The Honourable Chairman is absolutely right. It's not what they said they would do at the last election. It's what we said they said they would do at the last election. Because we just have to look at the plans to see that the proposal that they were making created the sort of school that had been roundly rejected in the United Kingdom by the teaching profession has been bad for the people and been bad for the people. That's what we're not going to do.
One question in relation to, I'm grateful to the Chief Minister for explaining his position in relation to GSD policy, but it's evident from the numbers of questions that have been asked by both sides and the other side of this side of the House, Mr. Speaker, it's quite clear that there's a genuine interest in parents and members of the community as to the detail of the government's ambitious, in their own words, programme to deliver education for our community for the next 30, 40, 50 years for our community. But it's therefore, my question to the Minister is this, that is he willing to explain more of the detail as to their programme on rolling out new schools for our community, which is quite clear from questions that have been asked in this House, that not enough answers have been given by the government in relation to schools.
Because the details, of course the details are given, the details are being shared already, as has meetings with teachers, as has meetings with parents, the director of education has meetings with those, more meetings are scheduled, some of the methods are currently under discussion, some of the more intricate designs of the comprehensive schools are currently being worked through in working groups of teachers, so of course the details will be made available, and anybody who wants, all they have to do is ask. And I have answered the questions here, every question that I've been asked has been answered, and you know, like the answer, or agree with what I'm saying, but we're hiding absolutely nothing at all.
Mr. Speaker, sir, arising from the Chief Minister's explanation, he said, I hope it is you speak correctly, the only shared facility is the disaster of the library. Yeah? Can the Chief Minister and the Minister then help explain why teachers of secondary schools have been told as recent as this week that, for example, the teaching of hairdressing type of course, the students that will only be set up in one school and the students have to commute. Is that not the same as sharing the facility?
We can account for that. Crossing the country has never been described seriously as commuting in the English language.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, I amend that word as being that I was taking a walk across this area.
Okay, we are currently in the in designing the precise allocation of space in the two new comprehensive schools. And we're currently involved at the same time in developing new vocational courses. Therefore, we have to consider in the two schools where we do not believe there will be an uptake between all the boys and girls who, for example, have two hairdressing facilities, which of the schools will host that, and then the other school will host possibly something completely different. Exactly as is the case today when the six-point consortium. It only means that if we start vocational courses as the equivalent of GCSE, we may have to have the consortium working further down for specific things which we should not, in the space of the voter, provide key for, Mr. Speaker. And the fact that the schools are different but close together means it is easier for students of the two schools, where the two separate uniforms, to not commute but walk across the castle in order to make use of those facilities. It makes exactly instead of going to the Mr. Speaker, it makes absolute sense and it's being developed in conjunction with the teachers.
Speaker, the Chief Minister has referred to efficient use of cash and effective economy of scale, and the Minister has just referred to efficient use of resources. Can I ask the Minister whether his department is undertaking any kind of impact, economic impact analysis of the allocation of resources and indeed the funding of the school? Does he have at this moment in time any indication of what the cost of building these schools would be to share with us, or if he were not willing to share that with us today, would he be willing to share that with us if I take a specific question?
Mr. Speaker, I am asked by the current leader, I won't say country, the current leader of the opposition, as to whether I'm going to provide information, and the former leader of the opposition obviously didn't hear information that has already been stated in the past. So we have said that because there is going to be a tender process, we are not in a position, we are not willing to put a cost in the public domain our estimated cost of the school.
I'm getting to a minute. Am I asking just one supplementary on this? Would you expect, in his estimation, is it the government's expectation role, that the cost of construction less the sale of the existing land would effectively cost neutral to the government, or would it be a net cost to the government, or you just don't know?
Specifically, the answer definitely seems to want to make everyone the Minister for Finance, except the Minister for Finance. And he's asking questions of the Minister for Education, so he's very good at finance. What are the issues of financing of the schools? The answer to the question in relation to the financing of the schools remains as I set out in my answer to him in the last Parliament. But, Mr. Speaker, that calculation that he wants us to do, I don't think it is wise one for him to invite us to do, if we are both keen to ensure that we get the best possible value for the sector when it comes to the competitive process for the building of these schools by told them we're going to conduct them.
Mr. Speaker, would I like to ask if the government will be engaging in a formal consultation with teachers and parents in the next coming months before the details are finalized?
Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure in relation to what. Obviously, not for education, not industry. The teachers are currently involved in developing and designing the content of the detailed allocation, so that once it's not in here, and I have already reached out to those schools which have a parent association in order to give them an opportunity to discuss it with
them. I think this will be the final supplementary. Did the government consider providing special education schools in other locations in Gibraltar, for example, in the north and the south?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Would it be possible to know what other locations the government did consider?
Mr. Speaker, I have said publicly on a number of occasions, and I will say again, one of the hardest things to deal with in politics in Gibraltar
is the Rubik's Cube of where you put one thing away, you put another. So when you consider it, this, you consider every location, every potential location. Because even if one of the names might think that there is something on it today, that I'm going to be in a position to move something that may be there today, or hurry along those that may be there today, with inducement or otherwise. So every possible location has been considered, and this is the location that has been considered, and for a number of reasons to be the most appropriate. We are entirely committed to ensuring that we deliver on our manifesto statement and the additional opportunities that we've identified. We think this is the right way to do it. The honourable governor is now conducting that consultation exercise. He's taking people to the board, whether they're teachers or whether they're parents. I don't know how many times we can say it, Mr. Speaker, but if the honourable government simply wants to give us an opportunity to affirm that, the government is entirely committed to that personal consultation, which we have indicated we invite them.
One question in relation to 712. That's in relation to the experts that the government has consulted in relation to the, or taken opinions from in relation to new schools. Can the government confirm who and what type of expert they are?
This is in the form of visits to schools, highly regarded schools in the UK, and discussions with the education authorities in that part of the UK. Both the part of my department team and some teachers have attended meetings in the UK at those schools, which includes a thank you, yes, a very relevant point that I have said for a moment. So apart from the fact that the team has visited schools in the UK, the design models are based on the local Department for Education modelling of school construction and design in the UK. So we have actually used the latest Department for Education UK Department of Education type of a model, and we have been in touch with people in the Department for Education who design schools. So we've done both the general guidelines for design and also visited actual schools to learn from their experiences there.
Question number 718, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Housing provide details of how many tenants required urgent conformity from their homes since the answer provided to question number 179 of 2017, indicating the reason why, the date when said decanting became necessary, and the date when the tenants were able to return to their homes?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, since the answer to question 179 of 2017, six tenants have required urgent decanting from their homes as a result of fires, substantial water ingress, and major work. One was decanted in March, one in April, one in August, three in September. Except for one household, all tenants have returned to their flats in June, September, and October.
And the one who was not returning to the house is the one that left the house in which month, so that at least this is an indication of how long that person has had to be away from the house.
The remaining one, Mr. Speaker, was decanted on the last day of September and is due to return imminently, hopefully this week.
Question number 719, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing say how much expenditure has been incurred in respect of legal costs relating to the eviction of quarters and diamonds rental homes since the answer to question number 180 of 2017, providing a breakdown showing the number of homes involved and to whom payments were made?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, KMCI have been paid a total of £1,045 in relation to evictions from two properties.
Question number 720, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of all expenditure incurred since the answers to questions number 181 of 2017 and written question number 1574, I take the event of 2017, in respect of contracts awarded for making empty homes suitable for relocation, stating to whom payments were made, how much has been paid, the number of residential homes pertaining to each payment, as well as indicating the type or nature of repair work for cleaning services and replacement.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, details are as follows. Keyway, 17,127 for two properties. Aquaria Services Company Limited, 7,140 for one property. AMK General Services Building, 359,933 for two properties. TJVS, 89,945 for 23 properties. Elite, £29,554 for two properties. Trade Overseas, £9,809 for one property. Ace Plumbing, £7,400 for one property. 501 Construction, £18,805 for two properties. The works carried out by these companies were all for general refurbishment work, such as plastering, walls, ceilings, taking down walls, painting, replacing floor tiles, doors, plumbing, and electrical work.
Question number 721, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Mr. Speaker, further to the answer provided to question number W, which is a written question 161 in 2017, can the Minister for Housing provide details of how many of the 11 rented homes which were in the process of being cleaned and refurbished have now been allocated and or assigned, inclusive of room for possession of said homes from the stock return for new tenants who have recently moved into South Reform House?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, since the answer to question 161, a further 5 flats has been allocated.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, I know from the previous answer that the 11 and now 5, but I now have here inclusive of the room composition of said homes. Looking at the answer I got to written question number 161, where the Minister kindly listed all the 66, I had no idea the room sizes for the composition of the 11 that have to be cleaned. Although the 11 sizes have been allocated, but I have no idea what the size of the homes were, nor of the remaining 6 what the homes are. Perhaps the Minister has the information I need to satisfy my... I need the answer now to continue my talk with constituents.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is right. I don't have it in my answer, nor do I have it as a supplementary. I'm sorry, but I will provide it to the Honourable Gentleman. I apologise if I haven't been provided to you.
Mr. Speaker, may I, because you know that the Honourable Lady and myself quite often are able to spend simple measures, because they are, you know, have a conversation, but I don't want to get the information in my past, you know, just passed it on to me. If it happens to be in a supplementary session, so much better, because I think the speaker will allow you to be able. But if not, Mr. Speaker, I'm not a senator. It doesn't require to be a senator. I will even accept it, you know, at any other stage. But I think that it's humanly possible, given that that has passed to be, you know, quite close to having that answer.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I certainly undertake to provide it, though unfortunately I won't be able to do so during the course of this afternoon because the staff have now left, but as soon as I have the information, I will.
Question number 722, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
So I ask to be answered provided the question number W191 of 2017. Can government say if and when the Montreal Community Management Company or Management Committee signed off all the remedial work as duly completed to the satisfaction, indicating if the said signing off has been done by individual blocks or in respect to the construction project as a whole?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, as in any construction project, it is the developer who signs off completed work. and money will be changed to ensure that any defects that may appear during the defect liability period are corrected. The management company or committee do not sign up on the works, although they are consulted, and meetings arranged if necessary if they feel that problems, there are problems that are not being resolved.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, the lady has a deep corrected name to write direction, not the management company who needs to sign it up. Could you indicate who it is and need to sign it up and make sure that the state government or government entity is what the system is yet?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, of course, government was the developer in relation to these projects. And the contractor has not yet been issued with a making good certificate. So we have retained money until something arises, as is normal in the process of construction works, and we will deal with it as and when issues arise. As far as we are, Mr. Speaker, I am satisfied that we don't have anything untoward or undue, but of course we will continue to remain to retain these monies until we are absolutely satisfied that there are no defects at all.
I'm grateful for that part of that, Mr. Speaker. So that I don't want to necessarily check with the people again next month. If the honourable member or the honourable minister, Mr. Speaker, will say, look, I expect within 3 or 6 months, or I could make a note in my diary or want to have a question. I know you need to speak up, you need to say, I need to put an office to call quite too often. So, in this indication, it could be perhaps within the first quarter of 2017 or the second quarter, I can then flag it up and we have an official answer for the record of point completion.
The issue that we have outstanding, Mr. Speaker, relates to water ingress issues that arose last year. These have been rectified, but before we can be satisfied of whether they have been rectified properly or not, we need to await the rains to come. So in terms of the time frame, Mr. Speaker, then perhaps the honourable member can ask me in early summer, and once we know that the heavy rain has ceased.
Or to put down another question before the summer recess. I would say, because the minister has been extremely on the way to that, I'm going to interpret early summer as sort of being once the winter is completed, so probably that's the real Easter recess that we have on, and whatever could be a good time. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 723, the Honourable A.J. Hayley.
Mr. Speaker, I have spoken with you, but for the benefit of the Parliament, this question is withdrawn. I'll be honest, there is an error in the way it's been given us. It makes sense, and I apologize if I wasted a minute's time in drafting what would have been a ridiculous question. No, what they said, I know. This is just like, I apologize, but I hope my math teacher forgives me a lot.
Question number 724, the Honourable Ellis Lamy.
Mr. Speaker, since December 2011, the Pentagon provided a schedule for the breakdown of government rental homes which have been allocated, including A, the room composition allocation, B, the date the applicants have originally joined the house of waitlist, C, where the property was handed over as a sales pitch for government furnished, D, the point the applicant had, E, the date the property was allocated.
On to the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Of a total of 1,145 allocations that have taken place since the 9th of December 2011, 188 have been on the self-prepared basis. I am handing over a schedule of the flat composition and date of applications. Mr. Speaker, while you wait, I'd like to thank the Honourable Gentleman in relation to the previous question. I must say that I was somewhat amused as to what the angle could possibly have been.
Question number 725, the Honourable Ellis Lennon.
The Speaker, can the government provide assistance with a breakdown of housing rental assistance who are on the social and medical list, including A, the year of the application for the sector, B, the number each individual is on the list, C, the room composition required, D, the number of points as at the end of each calendar year since December 2011.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, there are a total of 96 applicants. We have a medical category and 31 applicants for the social category. The breakdown is as follows. In terms of year of application, 2 in 2011, 3 in 2012, 6 in 2013, 16 in 2014, 20 in 2015, 34 in 2016, and 46 in 2017. Their position on the list displayed an exact rate. And in terms of home composition, this relates to 81 RKDs, 15 2 RKDs, 19 3 RKDs, 10 4 RKDs, and 3 5 RKDs. Points are calculated on the anniversary of each applicant's application date and therefore increases yearly. However, no points are allotted for the medical or social categorization, so we won't have everything.
Speaker, going back to question 724. The question asked for a complaint breakdown with room composition, the date, the applicant's name, the resolution, and so forth. The person provided, unfortunately, we can't marry the allocation with the date the person gave, with the number of points the person had when the property was allocated. Is this information that the ministry was able to provide?
Mr. Speaker, I want to agree with the fact that the question asked for that information to be made. I've looked carefully at the question and at the answer. The question is broken down in categories, and the answers have all been provided in the answer.
Mr. Speaker, there's no way that the question has been properly answered. There's no column indicating when the date of the property were allocated, the number of points the applicant had when they received the property, and there are other elements from this question that can be answered. And a question like this, I believe, would require that the components of the question be made so that we can properly analyze the allocation process that the government has had.
Mr. Speaker, with the greatest of respect to the Honourable Gentleman, I cannot possibly predict what it is that he wants or what he intends to marry, but the question is very clear, and the answer is very clearly in answer to the question that they are broken down, because I am asked, for example, to include the room composition allocated. That is in the first box overly. The date the applicant originally joined the housing list. There is a box saying an applicant joined the housing list. Then I'm further asked when the property was, whether the property was handed over as a self-fix, I think he means self-repair, which is the term that we use, or government furnished, that is answered as well. And there's a question in relation to the point, that is answered. And a date when that is allocated, and that's all answered with the speaker. The Honourable Gentleman needs to understand that the question will be answered in the way that it is asked. If he wants a different answer, Mr. Speaker, then maybe the Honourable Gentleman may wish to consider asking it a different way on the next occasion.
Mr. Speaker, the fact that the question is one question, not five questions, I think in itself explains what the answer should be. With regard to points, there's no way that the Minister has answered that question. There's no way that from the 1,145 allocations, it can be analysed the number of points that the person has, nor can it be analysed the period that the person, each person has been on the waiting list at the same time.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the part of the point, That is not here, but that is something the speaker would be so such a voluminous exercise to undertake in any event that it would be disproportionate for us to undertake, particularly in the period of time and resources that are available. But again, Mr. Speaker, I maintain that the questions have been asked in a particular way, and the answers have been provided in the way that they have been asked. And as I said, the Honourable Gentleman may wish to consider answering them a different way, asking them a different way, and the next occasion, if you want the answer in a particular way. I cannot possibly, Mr. Speaker, be in the Honourable Gentleman's mind and be guessing what he is trying to get at in the format that he wishes me to answer.
Question number 726, the Honourable Alice Young.
With the Speaker, since December 2011, can the government provide a statement of non-government friendly tenants who have been allocated the purpose to express to the elderly, such as other into house houses, one for people? Including A, the reasons why we need space, and B, whether or not the person was on the government side of waiting list.
On to the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, everyone who is allocated a flat is a housing applicant. An allocation of all flats are treated on this basis. Current records do not provide a breakdown to show the extent of a successful applicant's previous housing situation, and the task of looking through every single allocation of an elderly flat going back to 2011 would be unduly onerous and resistant.
Question number 727, the Honourable Ellison.
The Speaker, can the government provide a schedule based on the information received ahead of the time of the sale of feast to sell within one type of leave, including A, family composition of applicants or applicants, B, room composition of places, and C, the price of sale?
On to the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, the government does not hold a database of the family composition of purchases. The room compositions are as follows. There were 47 one-bedrooms, 312 two-bedrooms, 477 three-bedrooms, and 59 four-bedrooms. Properties are required to be registered, and as such, they are public documents and in the public domain.
Mr. Speaker, given that the policy of the government was that most or the priority was given to housing applicants, clearly, the government would have been dealing with the information, both of the housing code of family composition and the applicants were linked to the application being successful. Is this something that the government is not have?
Mr. Speaker, I think that the Honourable Gentleman has just answered his own question in that applicants were given priority and not the composition. And not the family composition of the purchases.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister has said that they do not hold this information, but clearly the Housing Ministry holds the information of the family composition of its housing applicants and on which list they are, and therefore they should be able to provide an answer with the flat composition that they purchased to them. Is this something that the government sees and does not have?
No, Mr. Speaker, because it's not the Housing Ministry that deals with the sale or the allocation of the flats. It is a government through the Bolton Residential Properties Limited. And so, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman does not seem to understand procedure. It's just more happening and passing and saying, for goodness sake. It may help procedure, Mr. Speaker, if the Honourable Gentleman were to inform himself of the procedure, because maybe by doing so, he may be in a better position to formulate his questions and answers arrive at the answer. Where he is seeking. This information, Mr. Speaker, is provided to me by Devoto Residential Properties Limited. If Devoto Residential Properties Limited tells me that they do not have this information at their disposition, then that is the answer that has been provided. It may well be, Mr. Speaker, that GRC would have to liaise with the Housing Department and go through all 1,000 applicants one by one to look at that. But that, Mr. Speaker, I would say is an unduly onerous use of resources in the circumstances.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm not sure I heard the honourable minister correctly. Did you say that, or did you indicate that, rather than provide the honourable friend information at the person's share, that the information was available on the purchase deed, which would be presumably registered a land property service, but you're not prepared to provide that outside information directly?
Well, Mr. Speaker, only because standing orders provide for this situation. And your documents are publicly available, and these documents are publicly available on a public register that's available to the public, then it's standing orders that is giving me this direction, Mr. Speaker, and I am clearly following standing orders, which is the matrix that we refer.
Okay.
Question number 728, the Honourable Elephant.
Mr. Speaker, since December 2009, Canada government provides details regarding affordable property for a subject that has been identified tentatively in the provision under the lease, and what action has been taken in this case, including the estate of property belongs to.
On to the Honourable Minister for Housing and Quality.
Mr. Speaker, when subletting is identified in a state where the Majesty's Government of Gibraltar is or has been the developer, such cases are investigated, and in the event that there is a breach of the underlease, appropriate action will be undertaken in accordance with the terms of the underlease. In some cases, subletting has ceased upon receipt of our notification. In other cases, investigations are ongoing and to establish the necessary evidence, and there are no instances of illegal subletting where the tenant is the government, as was the case prior to December 2011.
Thank you. Provide a breakdown and figures on how many follow-ups have been done by less and how many cases are currently being investigated.
No, Mr. Speaker, because it does not form the body of the question, nor do I have the information, otherwise I would, of course, disclose it. From memory, I know it's a handful. Roughly, Mr. Speaker, in case in terms of the ones that have been brought to my attention, I would say possibly roughly four, and maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less, but no more than four, I think, have been brought to my attention.
Mr. Speaker, can I ask the Honourable Minister? I know that in respect of Obama and Rental, we did set actually an anonymous hotline where your members could sort of report to look, I think, so they're not actually living in that kind of area. Is there a similar sort of setup? I know we could be opening up a kind of world, but I'm asking for that I may guide some people in the future, you know, where I've heard people within the community to say where I live, they're saying, you know, don't you remember where you used to live there, and the people are there now, and they don't even look Gibraltarian and belong to. You know, so there is a reasonable doubt whether that house has been. Because the management company, you see, the other shareholder within one of these corners of the state, the management company can disclose to you as a shareholder who the particular house belongs to. So we then have the police detective work to be done, you know, if it's been a couple of times.
I don't know whether the honourable gentleman will recall, I think we were both members of the house when as a result of similar anonymous tip off resulting from similar sort of identification, that we brought to the House a similar concern. And failing to find was a very candid former Minister for Health, rightly put his hand up and said, well, now that you mention it, the government has been subletting those apartments for people of another origin who have come to assist the health authority. The former leader of the opposition, Mr. Peter Gavano, who is the minister, agreed with the fact that he just found out about that and this did not continue. So there are many circumstances of those things can arise, and some information all the members have which they might be able to bring to our attention, I would ask them to do so. Not in this forum necessarily, but to speak to the record, because there are breaches of the underlease
will be looking over the deep homes that are provided at the cost of the low cost that they are provided, not for speculation, not for rental, so that people can make a profit other than the capital value of sale, but they're prepared in this way, and this is an agreement between both parties for some time that it should be the patient that was instigated by the government led by Joe Bassano, that these homes should be for owner occupation, so that we can house and grow Gibraltarian families, not that that people can use these to turn a fair penny either by realizing capital value or rental value. So any information that the members have just to bring to our attention. I do believe that there has been an edict from the day that we were elected that certainly the government does not involve itself in renting these properties now and do of its own and the list of his paper authorities for cases.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker, I want to keep to point out that's exactly why in my substantial answer I said that there have been no instances of this prior, of this since December 2011. But having said that, and the honourable gentleman refers to a hotline which may have existed in the past, I don't remember, but in the last 6 years I think that the need for a hotline has declined because it's all been overtaken by a phenomenon called social media. And you will find that in any event that someone finds out of anything untoward going on in anything, you will find a post at some point on Facebook and Twitter or in something. And when it doesn't, and I'm grateful to the honourable gentleman, if you once came across a space of some irregularity and he immediately brought it to my attention, and in the same way that he does, many people who come across this information in public fora do bring it to my attention. And of course, people do also contact the housing department in the normal way as well when they hear of irregularities or perceived irregularities. So I'm quite satisfied that the channels of communication in that respect work. And we do, of course, follow them up, and when necessary, we do engage with the police or the Board of Inquiry agency to go in and investigate and verify occupants there.
In relation to that, just out of interest, has the government conducted analysis when individuals apply for advantage for residency and sort of targeting effectively the question at those that acquire rentals in order to possibly form affordable housing, as to whether there's a joined up system where if the relevance to the status department would understand this individual is now renting in an affordable house. Is there a joined up process by which they can acknowledge and recognise those individuals and therefore enforce the terms of the underlease and deal with that problem head on?
Yes, the system is joined up in that respect. So the addresses are obvious because the government is being the developer and promoter of those addresses. And whenever an application comes in from an address which should not house an individual that collects those characteristics that the honourable gentleman has referred to, the individual's ability to reside in that address is questioned. There are some circumstances where it is acceptable, for example. And I can recall an instance, which is a little bit of an ability to note, of an individual seeking resident status from such an address when he had not been in Gibraltar for long enough to avail himself of residency. Because it turned out he had arrived in Gibraltar as a child, not many years before, because he had arrived, I think, after the age of 14, but before the age of 18. He had resided there as a result of a relationship between one of his parents and a local, and was now emerging from that relationship, seeking his own status for the years. Rightly resident there and had not in any way been induced in London to the result. So, therefore, it was expected that he could be potentially used at that address for that purpose. But in most instances, so there isn't a receipt in the detail I'm giving him, but this is questioned, we understand what's happening, and if somebody is using that address for purposes of an application and being the resident in that address, it's possible. The issue the honourable gentleman refers to, which is one that I'm very alive to, usually arises in the context of private lettings, of private dwellings, not in affordable housing estates. So usually in the context of areas which are never been at the practice of having this development. Sometimes in the old time, the government has never stayed, and I have 20 or 30 people residing in one address. Those tend to be noted because of the headquarters computerization, it's immediately easier. So, yeah, if you live in an apartment where there are 2 bedrooms and 40 alleged residents, if you explain to us the miracle of the system and how you will feed yourselves each night, let alone sleep, and that system is growing up among you.
Question number 729, the Honourable Ellis Lennon.
Mr. Speaker, why did the government not set up an online application system for the affordable housing project?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Housing and Policy.
Mr. Speaker, the application phase has not yet commenced, and the process is at expressions of interest stage, the questionnaire for which is available online.
Well, Mr. Speaker, it's online, but you haven't downloaded print and information tonight, from what I've understood from the viewpoint. There have been over 4,000 expressions of interest. So, therefore, my question is, why was this not online as a form which you would have submitted, and a database would have been created rather than have such an onerous task of civil servants or current employees, and to go through each and every application for expressions of interest?
Mr. Speaker, the way that the form has been devised requires an applicant to complete it in a way that we, as prospective developer, are analysing all these applications. Because one of the things that can happen, for example, is that people can forget to complete a particular box, whether there's an item required or ticking a box. This is the way that we've done it, Mr. Speaker. We have to, in the interest of expediency as well, Mr. Speaker, is to these forms, which are expression of interest forms, which are available online, because we wanted just to get them out, Mr. Speaker. And at the time, there was no to have a commission and have a database in place would have taken us long, Mr. Speaker. It may be something that we consider for the formal application stage, but certainly it's working for us now, Mr. Speaker, because of the manner in which the applications have been returned, and some applications have been returned to us in a phased process, because we gave quite a long time for applicants to return their applications, and it has not been as onerous a process as the Honourable Gentleman wants to make it out to be. It's been completely workable. The deadline has now just recently closed, and we are in the process now. The database is complete, Mr. Speaker, so it hasn't, the manual entry of the database hasn't caused us any delay whatsoever, and we're in the process of analysing the results of that process.
And so, Mr. Speaker, is 4,000 applications, is not an owner of staff providing an answer to 1,145 applications. Shouldn't be that much of an owner of staff using the same benchmark the Honourable Lady using.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Government is missing apples prepared and transferring to the same way. It is impossible to explain to him again why these things are different. If you have a tick box exercise, you can do it, Mr. Speaker, on a Google form. So people can be asked not to fill in a handwritten form, and just on a Google form say, how many bedrooms do you want to say? But this is a form that actually requires also an expression of some of the circumstances of individuals. And that is something that is being collated in the exercise that is being done for the purposes of producing better affordable development. Now, going in the context of 5 days, which is the period in which we are to answer questions, to 1,500 different forms to extract the information in the manner in which the Honourable Gentleman has decided this month that he wants it,
is not something that is a worthwhile use of government rights that can be deployed in the time available to produce the answer available. You see, we don't see what information honourable members wish to have. If they wish to have it, and it is something that the civil servants can produce in the time available, we provide it to them. Members on the side of the House do not tell those who are in the civil service not to produce something. We don't tell them to tell us that it's onerous to produce it. They simply say to us, look, it's impossible for me to produce an answer to this question without entirely paralyzing the department for 3 months and doing the exercise of what to be able to stand by the accuracy of the information. That is the reality of the situation. But the opportunity can continue to ask questions, to pile up the request for statistical information over an exceedingly long period of time. The recipient will not be able to provide it unless he prefers that the government should stop work on everything that is dealing with at the political and administrative level in order to answer his questions. I think everybody in this community would agree, probably himself included, that we should just step and get on with the job and not be sidetracked by some of the things that we make us try to produce for him and which are statistically almost impossible to provide the accuracy.
Question number 730, the Honourable Elton.
And how will the government ensure that affordable homes are not forced by those choosing to make the profit moving forward?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, the government is considering various measures to prevent those seeking to profit from resale primarily by reviewing the restrictions on returns.
Question number 731, the Honourable Ms. N.D. Hassan Nam.
Is government satisfied with how Gibraltar Car Park is handling the issue of the car's barrier at Charles de Sunhouse?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, initial teething problems with the barrier have been rectified. As far as the Housing Department is aware, no further issues have been reported. Mr. Speaker, the barrier has already come down on some vehicles and individuals and on the head of a workman. But the response from the car park has been that they are not responsible for any damage, injury, or theft. So, Mr. Speaker, can the Minister confirm whether this is the case? And if so, does government make itself responsible for injuries in place of the Gibraltar car park?
The government has not had notice of any person being injured by a barrier or any of the things that the Honourable Lady has referred to. So we don't answer questions in the hypothetical. If they want to write to us with the information, we will look into it. If we haven't received claims, then it's impossible for us to be able to make any assessment.
Mr. Speaker, not even in the hypothetical, these incidents have happened, and the question remains, who is responsible for injuries? Can the government say one way or another? Because Gibraltar Car Park is saying that it's not them. So can government confirm that they are responsible? Somebody has to be responsible.
Speaker, you may say this is not even in the hypothetical, but we on this side of the house are. Because what I'm saying today, we have not had notice on this side of the house. After her question, those at the relevant department have not brought to the attention of those on this side of the house any such claims. I mean, if the Honourable Lady has notices when these claims are made, we can go back and look at on what basis it is alleged that liability has been denied. But we're genuinely telling her that for us, this is hypothetical because it hasn't happened.
Mr. Speaker, I have been in touch, or rather, the Tenants Association of the Charles de Sun House have been in touch with me because they said that they won't be listened to. So, from what I remember, since they have I think they have made representations. Excuse me. I'd like to explain this if anybody wants to listen. But I think that they've made representations already and they've tried to go to Papa Scott and they've been told that they're not responsible. And I think that the question still remains, which hasn't been answered, who is responsible for injury and why do I have to bring anyway a specific case to get an answer for that? Who's responsible for injury? If the Gibraltar Cup has to say that they're not responsible for injury, will government confirm that they are?
No, Mr. Speaker, because injury can arise as a result of many different circumstances. And depending on the circumstances, different parties may be responsible for injury or for damage. Those issues are legal issues, Mr. Speaker. Neither the government, nor car parks, nor charity funds, nor health care associations can get away from that. It's a straightforward legal issue. And if you slip on the banana, Mr. Speaker, the person who left the banana seems the person responsible. But it doesn't mean that the government is ultimately responsible. So, if you're already saying that a person, a tenant association, has not been listened to in something as serious as injury or damage, I put it to that, Mr. Speaker, that I would be aware of this because I would have had at least a letter from the tenant association that may or may not have been copied to her and to the legal view of the position, whether he or she may be at a particular point in time, or to Robert, Mr. Lama, to the Speaker, and I get these letters all the time. I mean, and I pay attention whether or not they're copied to the Honourable Lady, the Honourable the legal view of the position from time to time, whether he or she may be accepted sister. But that, I think there is a developing mutual frustration between the Honourable Lady and this side of the House in respect of this question, because she thinks something has happened, we're telling her we haven't had notice. Can I just say to her, Mr. Speaker, that we're happy to look into this with her and to try and address any similar situations we may still have arisen, but we have do not have notice of car park denying liability in respect of a tenant association claim for either injury or for damage.
Question number 732, the Honourable Ms. M.D. has announced.
Can government confirm whether they have any plans to install fire retardants in government estates, and if so, by when?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, concrete, which is the main component in most modern-day buildings and the most certain same government estates, is inherently fire retardant material. This, together with other composite materials, whose structural abilities are not debilitated quickly by heat and fire, constitutes the main building government estate. Thus, fire retardant qualities are integral in this type of build. Mr. Speaker, on the 29th of September, I issued a press release just after the Moorish Castle estate fire in Keighley House asking about fire retardants. I have been waiting for 2 months for an answer, and I don't think actually have received an answer. In the wake of Grenfell and indeed the Keighley House fire, and in view of all the money and the priority that this government puts to other important elements of our society, like building new schools and refurbishing them, how is it that placing fire retardants, which are necessary, concrete or no concrete, alarms, sprinklers, are necessary? Or will they be happy to tell tenants across government estates that they are not needed or that they should rely on the two dogs who saved them in the last fire? Mr. Speaker, 2 points here. One point of order. Mr. Speaker, I answer to this House and I answer to questions in Parliament. I don't answer to questions because if I were to be answering every single question that everybody from the opposition were to issue, then I wouldn't get any work done, Mr. Speaker. I have my agenda, Mr. Speaker, there are things that I have to do. So that I find it completely unacceptable that I should be appealed for not having replied to a question which is the one. So if I just every single other one, Mr. Speaker. I will reply to a question in Parliament. That's number one. And number two, Mr. Speaker, I don't think the Honourable Lady understands what a fire retardant is. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, she may be asking me a different question, but she has used the wrong language. And therefore, my answer is in relation to the language that she has asked. I think she wants to ask me a different question, but can I ask you to consider that formulating a different question on the next occasion? But Mr. Speaker, I can reassure the public that the government is taking the issue of fire and fire risks and fire hazards extremely seriously. Immediately upon the disaster at Central Towers, the Chief Minister and I met with key individuals from the government department, and we set up a working group that has looked into every single issue of fire in relation to our high-rise buildings and our estates. That has been an in-depth consideration of everything that may be relevant to fire, fire prevention, fire safety, and fire awareness, Mr. Speaker. The matter has been dealt with very responsibly, taken very seriously, and I'm afraid, Mr. Speaker, one of the ladies is asking the wrong question.
Mr. Speaker, just one supplementary question in relation to that point. So, therefore, given the government has considered every single issue in relation to fire risk and fire retardant in relation to public housing, therefore, my question is the government satisfied with the government's response to this and indeed satisfied with the measures that are in place to reduce and in an attempt to eliminate that risk of fire?
Mr. Speaker, the government is satisfied with the government's response to this.
Mr. Speaker, is the government satisfied that our housing estates are safe in light of the investigations conducted by the government themselves, and also in relation to the point that the learned and honourable friend opposite said in relation to looking into every single issue?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, absolutely. In particular, in the context of the safety of the housing estate. But arising out of the question where we have been asked in respect to fire retardant aspect of concrete, and as all honourable members will know, concrete is not flammable.
So, Mr. Speaker, how would government answer the victims, or not victims in totality, but those who were affected by the fire in Keighley House, who ended up having to thank the two dead dogs who barked their way into their death and alarmed them? Wouldn't they have done better to have some fire alarms over there?
Mr. Speaker, we would answer those who have suffered fire by commiserating with them, by being delighted that there were no injuries. But in the same way as fires occur, unfortunately, and not everybody has a smoke alarm. But not every government property is going to be fitted with a smoke alarm by the government. One of the ladies aware that modern smoke alarms even have the ability to look into a property. The technology has developed to such an that most fire smoke alarms have the ability to communicate. That if what the honourable lady is saying is that every government property should be fitted with a smoke alarm, then that is not where she started. And if she is making that proposal in the future, I will put it to her that it is something that not everybody will support and something considered entirely inclusive. But everybody has the right to fit a smoke alarm in their home if they wish to, Mr. Speaker. Now, the rules in relation to sprinklers, fire alarms, etc., apply to certain buildings at a certain height, and the government is satisfied that all of its buildings comply with those rules, and if there are changes to the rules, then that we will ensure that our buildings comply with those changes to the rules. If there are changes in the United Kingdom to the rules, we will have an eye to those changes to understand whether there are changes which must be applied in Gibraltar as well, and if necessary, we will make available funding to comply with those requirements. I think that would be in the context of my budget speech, that would be the case, that the Honourable Lady would have funding available if they needed funding for that purpose. But what I am very keen to do, Mr. Speaker, is that people should not be put to any unnecessary concern today because somebody had an accident X months ago and a fire was caused in somebody's home. But we cannot do and say that there were no fires in anybody's home. We cannot be on top of everybody's toaster. We cannot be on top of everybody's turkey at Christmas. I mean, unfortunately, these things happen, but we feel
genuinely that the mechanisms are in place to deal with such issues and issues when they occur. There may be accidents again in the future, and please don't there will be any serious injuries or fatalities, but there is no mechanism to stop that. So that's what the Honourable Lady is talking about.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, I know that the government in the very early stages of the initial concerns after the answer, they were very quick to conduct analyses and reply to letters from the news. With respect to concerns about the flagging, and those fears were allayed. And I understand government and that they're still only looking at whether they were allayed. But I know they've already taken some of the measures out clearly in communal areas as well, which is something ongoing, controversial though that is in some places. As part of those exchanges, we also, the government said they might look at the possibility of whether the risk assessment, the fire risk assessment that were being undertaken in the government-owned estates might be extended to those estates which are partially government-owned, less than 50-50 with all of our houses. Has any progress been made in that area and has government undertaken that analysis?
Mr. Speaker, yes, as one of the gentlemen said, it is indeed true that this committee has looked at all the aspects, made recommendations, such as the clearing of anything that may cause obstruction of communal areas and controversial as it may be, it's the right thing to do. We are advised by the Fire and Rescue Service that this can cause risk to life, and therefore we follow advice. The Fire and Rescue Service has been working very closely with the Housing Department, advising us on several issues. There are some action points that we have as a result of that committee, which we are working on, and one of the major ones is that we are soon to embark on an awareness campaign on fire prevention. And in relation to moving on to estates that may be following things up by government, we have been liaising with them through the management companies as is the proper structure to do so, through our agents and property services. So far as covering our bases through that committee, I have to commend the committee for working extremely hard and looking at all the eventualities and advising us through the process.
Question number 743, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Mr. Speaker, further to the answer provided through supplementary questions arising from question number 658 of 2017, can the Minister perhaps say on which date the three charged United States as concerned AME Department will be?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, as I noted to the Honourable Gentleman, in answer to a supplementary question, all feed stocking levels in AMD were increased from 1 to 3 price losses on the 1st of April of this year. These posts have been continuously frozen. Because we don't have any necessary misunderstanding. Normally, in those who have dealt with trade union backgrounds and so on, I'm sure the part of the House wouldn't manage to perhaps clear any initiatives of the Act. When you talk about the posts being filled, it's normally understood that that post is now being allocated to someone like on a substantive basis. Otherwise, the post is just being covered. So, let me try to explain. If the establishment covers for 3 nurses, and whilst you see those who are permanently going to be promoted to that grade and therefore take up that post, then you say the post is being covered. Whereby, the terminology, a post has been filled, means that 3 applicants have been successfully chosen through application and application. I will say, language is not, Mr. Speaker, we're not going to clarify this. I understand and I accept and not advocate that 3 persons are physically covering that position, but that is very different to 3 persons who are actually filling that position for message. And we clarify once and for all, so we don't necessarily need to understand it.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I think that the difference between the Honourable Gentleman and I is one of terminology. When we talk about case being filled by the VA, we're talking on either an acting capacity or rotation or permanency. I think the Honourable Gentleman, when you're hosting after you asked me the question, the supplementary question, whose question was, have boards been held and are there permanent, are these positions being permanently filled? And when I went back to the GHA, they advised me that there had always been staff nurses occupying those posts, but that the adverts were issued on the in July. The interviews were held on the 9th of November. There were 7 applicants, and of course, 3 were successful.
Yes, yes. And Mr. Speaker, taking that following the 9th of November, this year, 9th of November, let's call it the board election or whatever, the three were successful. Is the minister aware, like, are they now already set the post? Because sometimes one needs a couple of weeks for the consistency to locate your own post. You have to hand over to somebody. It's just so that I have an indication if they're already there permanent or about to become one. We'll take it to be happening shortly.
By the same argument that you are making, the post has been filled on the 9th of November. Interviews are held on the 9th of November, appointments are made, the post
is filled. The post is filled, yes, Mr. Speaker, no doubt. I'm not just speaking. The post is filled on the 9th of November, and they're asking, is the person in city? Have they moved already to the AME?
Mr. Speaker, the successful applicants require approval from the Public Service Committee. So I'm not certain whether the successful applicants have already been notified or not. The board, as I said, only took place quite recently on the 9th of November.
That means that boards have been held on behalf of the Public Service Commission. Recommendations have gone to the Public Service Commission, and then the Public Service Commission has to confirm those and then advise the governor of the appointment.
And as and when the Public Service Commission advises the governor, it is filled as in that, not as in the 9th of November.
But to be clear, Mr. Speaker, there have always been 3 staff nurses in those roles since the increase was announced on the 1st of April.
Question number 734, the Honourable A.J. Phillips. Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm the ages of young offenders who have been sentenced to terms of imprisonment on the 15th of November 2016 through the 15th of November 2017, in the last 12 months?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the answer to this question together with questions 735 to 737.
Question number 735, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm the number of young offenders who have received custodial sentences from the 15th of November 2016 to the 15th of November 2017?
Question number 736, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm the reoffending rate of the current prison population by reference to percentage over the last 3 years?
Question number 737, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm how many young offenders have been disposed by the court other than financial penalties and imposed of immediate imprisonment?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that during the past 12 months, 2 young offenders were sentenced to imprisonment, one aged 13 and the other aged 14. Mr. Speaker, we're not able to advise of the reoffending rate of the current prison population over the time period required unless the reoffending has met full prison sentence. In this respect, 21.6% of the current prison population have had previous convictions resulting in prison sentences during the past 3 years. Mr. Speaker can confirm that 7 young offenders' cases were disposed by the court other than by means of financial penalties and periods of immediate imprisonment.
Speaker, really, there's a reference I'd like to make to the rehabilitation centre's question, but I said I know I'm not going to get an objection from my Honourable Learned Friend in relation to this point. But I can link it certainly to the reoffending rate, which I think is an interesting statistic, that 71% of the current population, as I understand the question, have reoffended but have had previous periods of custodial sentences served. I think that's the analysis that the Honourable Minister for Justice gave. But just linking it to the rehabilitation centres and the government's programme to do that, through employment, through work and through opportunity. I asked a question last time round in relation to whether the government had any intention of amending the rehabilitation of offenders legislation. And I just wanted to correct the record in relation to that question. I made the comment that the Minister may have been mistaken in relation to one aspect of the top end. And the Minister is very helpful in that period of time. We've had a discussion about it offline, as it were, and the Minister is correct. And I'm grateful for the clarification that both he and his department have afforded me in relation to that question. Mr. Speaker, in respect of answer to question 736, just to be clear that the Honourable Gentleman have understood the answer that I've given them, what I've told them is that I'm not in a position to advise them of reoffending rates unless the person who has reoffended is sentenced to prison, to a sentence of imprisonment. That is the only data that's available to us. By that measure, only 21.6% of the current prison population are serving an additional prison sentence over the past 3 years. That is not to say that there are 70-odd% of the prison population who have not reoffended. In other words, the only measure that we have is that there are 71% of the current prison population who have had previous convictions resulting in prison sentences. But we can't provide any additional data other than that. But to be of further assistance to him, if you see the following defaulting, there are currently 51 prisoners in custody, as at the date that the answer was drafted. Excluding fine defaulters, the number of reoffenders goes from 11 to 7, which is 13.7% of the current prison population. Of these 7, 3 have reoffended once during the last 3 years in addition to the current sentence. So that is additional granular information for him.
Question number 738, the Honourable Alexander.
The Speaker, since December 2011, the Pentagon provided several arrests made by Royal Divorce Police on drug-related offences, detailing A, whether the arrest was in relation to possession and intent to supply, B, personal use, C, A, and B, type of drugs involved.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 739.
Question number 739, the Honourable Alex Young.
The Speaker, since December 2011, the government provided a schedule of substance abuse related cases requiring medical care from the community care, food saving A, age, B, type of drugs involved.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested is contained in the schedule that I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman. Please know, Mr. Speaker, that the database for the year of the 1st of April 2016 to the 31st of March 2017 had corrupt files, therefore rendering the information unreadable or unreadable indecipherable. However, we've been able to extract some information over the time period of the 1st of April to the 31st of March in a different format to the other tables. Mr. Speaker, in respect to answer to question 739, the DSM is unable to provide the specific statistics for the period of December 11 to May 2015. The information requested from June 2015 to October of this year is contained in the schedule I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman.
The
said is all anything, so we're going to move on to the next question. And if any supplementary arrives, we will come back to you. Please call the next question.
Question number 740, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassanon.
Is the Minister of Justice confident that the legal assistance reforms we will enact will sufficiently expand access to justice?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I quote, although at this stage it is only a proposal for a pilot scheme, my sense is that it strikes the right balance between enhancing access to justice by those with limited means and not imposing an inordinate burden on the taxpayer. It is an exercise in lateral thinking which allows for the introduction of a much needed decent political scheme. Those, Mr. Speaker, are the words of the Honourable the Chief Justice at the opening of the legal year. I agree with his assessment of the proposed reforms. The proposed legal assistance reforms were circulated on the 2nd of October of this year as a consultation paper attached to Government Press Release number 575. This was a joint paper and proposal for a 3-year pilot project and in terms agreed between the Government and the Bar Council. I set out in the consultation document. The proposed new statutory architecture would see an increase in the financial eligibility threshold for legal assistance from 5,000, a sum set in 1990, to over 14,000, being 50% of the average annual income in divorce. This would, in effect, mean that persons in full-term employment and on the minimum wage would be eligible to receive legal assistance. The proposed new system also increases the amount of capital and the amount of equity in an applicant's home that the registrar may disregard when deciding to grant legal assistance. The reforms also include changes to the scope of legal assistance to ensure that taxpayers' money is not used in excessive cases where there is no strong or compelling public interest in making legal assistance available or where controls of expenditure are being introduced in the interest of the taxpayer by limiting the cost payable in certain cases. Our meeting with stakeholders on Thursday to progress matters now that the consultation has been completed. I am certain that the changes agreed will sufficiently expand access to justice, especially when combined with the judicial literature scheme that will be introduced at the same time for criminal matters. Mr. Speaker, may I conclude by quoting a local Queen's Council who said, the proposed reforms to legal assistance and the introduction of a judicial literature scheme that form part of the consultation exercise are very far-reaching and significant. The proposed increase in the legal assistance threshold would increase the potential pool of applicants for legal assistance significantly, and for the first time, give financial assistance to many individuals who need access to the court or have been prevented in the past from recourse to the court for determination of any dispute because they could not afford the cost of litigation. It will significantly improve access to justice. Likewise, the introduction of a duty to this proceeding has been long-standing and will secure advice and representation to persons in custody, thus securing a basic fundamental right. The Council looks forward to responses to this consultation exercise. Those, Mr. Speaker, are the words of the then chairman of the Bar Council, Peter Capardi QC, on the 7th of October of this year.
Mr. Speaker, thank you for that lengthy answer to the Minister for Justice. What I'm more interested in is what will be done to correct and repair this perception of injustice which the community is feeling in the wake of a trial like the Maratha trial, which cost in the region of $12 million. And I am aware about the difference between legal aid and legal assistance, Mr. Speaker. But following a trial where millions have been made available just for one case when there are so many other cases of innocent people who are vulnerable and needy, will the government be raising more public and community awareness about these reforms to make it evident to members of the community, to needy members of the community who might not be so aware and tuned in and need to know that these changes have been implemented?
Ms. Speaker, I think that is a rise from the preface to the fundamental. In the first place, the Honourable Lady was quick to recognise these reforms relate to legal assistance, which relates to civil matters and not to criminal matters. Mr. Speaker, while there was not the Minister for Justice at the time he was the Honourable Minister Lucidi, he then called the Cabinet discussion correctly. There was robust advice that said that legal representation had to be afforded to the defendants, and it was not to result in any challenge of justice, and that therefore the legal aid had to be provided appropriately to the right of others for there to be equality around. If I recall the advice correctly, and I stand to be corrected, and is anybody in services?
Again, we are not going to have a debate about the Mahatma case.
Mr. Speaker, just to clarify what the Honourable Member has said in relation to the advice, and I have given this information to the House before. Not quite that the advice was that this needed to be done to avoid a miscarriage of justice. This needed to be done to avoid the case being thrown out on an abuse argument with the court. So that was the clear advice we had from the Attorney General, and therefore we are still in accordance with that advice.
Thank you, the Honourable Minister. And also, Mr. Speaker, in respect and focusing on legal assistance, as I told the House, this is now at the stage where the consultation documentation has been issued and the consultation period concluded. I'm meeting the Bar Council on Thursday, and the result of the representations received by some law firms, especially the smaller law firms, that have some concerns, and we are meeting to discuss those concerns. But as I have pointed out by quoting the Honourable Chief Justice and by quoting the words of the former Bar Council chairman, we are all agreed that the reforms will in fact capture significant increases in access to justice for civil cases. In respect of promoting the reforms further, I think that we will certainly be in a position to do so once we are in a position to finalise and agree the final product, which will require changes to our legislation. But certainly at that point, a press release will be in order to once again explain how the reforms have been concluded and what the reforms mean in terms of legal assistance and eligibility to the general public.
Peter, just in relation to the question that was posed in relation to legal assistance and access to justice, I agree with the Honourable Minister that this will often these reforms with potentially potentially upgraded access to justice has been long overdue. But in relation to the confusion that was alluded to by my own friend, on this level, I'm not saying they're confused, but the confusion she alluded to in the public in relation to as to whether people get confused between legal assistance and legal aid. Yesterday, Mr. Speaker, there was a comment by a member of the public to me that why can't her daughter-in-law get access to justice? Why can't she get legal assistance? Vis-a-vis why Marachis have been afforded this gold-plated legal aid. Now, there is a confusion with the public, and although there's a clear distinction between the two funding arrangements, I think my reason now understands that I was getting that one point, it would be helpful if the Minister would consider explaining the difference, possibly to the public, in relation to the differences between criminal legal aid and civil litigation funded by way of legal assistance. I think it's important to help and to assist the public in communicating that. I know that the government has previously set out communicated generally to the members of the public, but I think it would be helpful because there is this underlying confusion within our community relating to those two points. And just one question that I've gone to his question in relation to duty solicitancy. I too have been in correspondence with members of the bar in relation to this very point, particularly those that practice in criminal law, and how law firms generally propose will be obliged, those that are five members and above, will be obliged to take part in the duty solicitancy. Is the government considering whether to target those that specialise in criminal law so that they can perfect their practice and actually increase their specialism rather than sort of making an obligation on law firms that may well practice in commercial, for example, property? My view would be that we should try to ensure that those criminal practitioners within our jurisdiction are able to develop their skills and to create that expertise that we need in our community.
Mr. Speaker, in respect of explaining the difference between the legal and the citizens, I take the honourable gentleman's comments on board, and it may be that the conclusion of the reforms and once the legislation is enacted, there may be some benefit in having some females online and also producing research to explain the eligibility of the public once the thresholds have been changed. In respect to the question of the article and the legitimacy of the feeling, I refer the honourable gentleman to page 5 of the consultation document, and I read from it. A proposal to be introduced by the registrar and thereafter adopted by the LSRA was established to enable the introduction of a compulsory digital scheme on the basis of a roster of law firms. All firms with more than 4 practitioners must take part. Firms of 1 to 4 practitioners can opt in.
To see up the question, but it also builds into many lawyers and all of us in this room who have practiced at the bar have given of our time pro bono many times, I'm sure, across both sides of this house in relation to the work we do for the public, wearing our other hats. But I wonder whether the government is going to encourage alternative forms of funding within our jurisdiction to also alleviate the public purse from possible pressures. From the changes in legal assistance, because quite clearly there is a risk that many applicants will come forward to access that justice and create a bigger burden on the public purse. Is the government considering other alternative forms of funding for litigation generally?
No, Mr. Speaker, we're not actively considering this at the moment because before we announced the consultation paper, my minister in particular did a lot of work on what would be the estimated amount that the government would spend once the reforms kick in. And as the consultation paper makes clear, we introduced scaled fees, and the older gentleman may know what I'm talking about when I say that it is a known fact that one particular area of the law has incurred, in the view of the general bar, a disproportionate amount of public funds relating to simple cases. And therefore, in the consultation paper, we make the point that for matrimonial cases where there are no children, we are limiting the amount and capping the amount lawyers can claim. But those are not the only categories in which we are capping and limiting the amount. There are other categories, and I refer the older gentleman to pages 2 and 3 of the consultation paper, where we introduce a schedule of fees, divorce proceedings, where there are no children, probate and administration disputes, so that we strike the balance between those cases which are simple and which only require limited correspondence and perhaps one or two appearances in court, and other cases where you cannot, with the best will and intention in the world, be able to estimate until you get to know the facts of the case how much effort is going to cost. So, having crunched those numbers and created new categories of cases which are scaled fees, we think, and without being in the honourable Chief Justice's mind, I suspect that is what he meant when he said that, in his sense, there is a right balance between enhancing access to justice by those of limited means and not imposing an inordinate burden on the taxpayer in an exercise of left-wing thinking. I think we may have been referring to that new category of cases where we have introduced scaled fees to keep a cap on costs, where we know from experience and on hard cap analysis, has perhaps produced a disproportionate amount of taxpayers' money previously in such cases.
In relation to the recent example of a single mother who was unable to access the system effectively and achieve access to justice so she could fund her case, one of the criteria I believe is that the equity of the formal matrimonial home is a key indicator for refusing access to justice and refusing funding. It's a difficult one, I appreciate, because you may well have a mother living in a fairly valuable property where she's unfortunately estranged from her husband and therefore really can't access the system because she doesn't have the means. I appreciate that it's a difficult subject, but quite clearly someone on one hand has equity in their property but actually has to access a lawyer who may be charging fairly large rates to conduct the matrimonial affairs, not only in relation to the division of assets, but also in relation to access to the interests of her children. And I wonder whether the government
is working through this. I've seen the boundaries in the document that the government has issued, but it obviously lies to that point, and there are the eligibility requirements for those where they have equity in the form of matching the home.
I believe this is the third supplement that I asked the younger gentleman, and I told him before to congratulate him on having become the leader of the Scottish Parliament, so I do not want to fill him up by telling him once again to refer to the document which actually on the first page sets out the expanded limit which are disregarded for the purposes of being eligible. And if you were to consider the very first page of the document, you will see that without commenting on a particular case, because either him or I will have a full fact before us to know whether or not that particular mother would be eligible under the reforms, proposed reforms, my instinct on having read, as he would have, the report in the Wolf Chronicle, it is more likely than not that he would be caught by the reforms of the proposal, but I make the point quickly that I'm not commenting on that particular case because every case has to be determined on its facts, and there may be many other reasons why a particular applicant, notwithstanding that he now fits in the new proposed threshold, may fall foul because of other reasons. But from the little bit I read on the report in the Chronicle, it would appear that given the amount of capital that we are excluding for the purposes of allowing eligibility to legal assistance, it would appear that that particular case would have been caught by the existing rules.
Question number 741, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, has any 66 LNG bunkering taken place in the vicinity of Gibraltar since December 2016?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Port.
Speaker, the question talks about the vicinity of Gibraltar, and I'm of course assuming that the Honourable Member is referring to British Gibraltar territory waters rather than anything else outside that which might be considered the vicinity of Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that no 66 LNG bunkering operations have taken place in British Gibraltar territory waters since December 2015.
Mr. Speaker, is there any particular reason for that? Is it demand? There has been no demand, but we were certainly led to believe before the last election that there would be significant demand for this. I think we were called ministers bobbing up and down on boats how this is the future. But then clearly there hasn't been a significant uptake from that response.
Speaker, we have to distinguish between 66 operations and the question talks of 56 LNG bunkers. So we have to distinguish between FPS transfers, 56 transfers, and bunkering operations. They are two very distinct things. FPS transfers are essentially cargo transfers between two ships. And those are the things when bunker supply operations. LNG FPS operations have happened. There have been transfers of cargo involving LNG, and there have been two operations that have occurred in March 2015 and June 2016. But with regard to LNG bunkering, the government has already announced that it is working with Shell in relation to developing the market, following in particular the International Maritime Organization's decision to reduce marine fuel cycle emissions globally to 0.5%. Or less than 1st of January 2020. So that is something that we're working on. We're also working on regulations, changes to the legislation. The legislation currently refers to bunkering generally, bunkering rules. We have to provide specific rules in relation to LNG bunkering. No FTF LNG operations have taken place in BBW from December 2015. There have been two FPS operations were not bunkering operations. There have been no LNG bunkering operations at all from the British territorial waters.
I'm going to speak it because I'm not an expert in this field. I really need to be concerned with the semantics and the abbreviation view. I'm very concerned with what the Minister is saying that LNG has not been transferred from one ship to another ship, but other bunkering or other transfer of cargo activities may have taken place between LNG fuel ships, but not actually LNG
reason for my trip to the other.
The information I have is that LNG FDS is the ship operation has taken place in two of them, and that they are the only remembered question about transport cargo and not transport of LNG is a little bit of a doubt in my mind. I had actually no doubt to disembark the transport of LNG from one ship to the other. That is very different to bunkering, which is a supply of fuel, whether it's LNG or other types of marine fuel. We don't have a base integrator, we don't have any base integrator currently offering LNG bunkering. We have other types of bunkering with carrier integrator, but we don't have a base with tank or mothership involving LNG for LNG bunkering. That will come, and that is a market that is being developed. That is the future, and that will happen. But cargo transport involving LNG vessels has happened on two occasions.
Question number 742, the Honourable
Kim. Mr. Speaker, the government in talks with any airlines regarding a possible uptake of the route to the UK lost with the demise of Monarch, and if so, when does government envisage a new carrier from its operations?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 743 of 2017.
Question number 743, the Honourable
Ellis Young. Following the collapse of Monarch Airlines, has it made any inroads with other airlines to increase our flight links to the UK?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, from Sunday, 2nd of October, the government has been in contact with both existing airline operators in Gibraltar and other operators from not only four airports that Monarch Airlines is serving, but also other airports. The government has also been in contact with the airports affected and also alternative UK departure airports. The government has made a business case to all of these airlines and exchanged information with airports with the aim of recovering these links to Gibraltar left vacant. As the Honourable Member will know from, the Honourable Members will know from two press releases that we have issued recently on the 27th of October, sorry, 27th of November, we announced that Supergate was conducting a series of classes next summer over a 4-week period across a week from Belfast International Airport, Humberside, Exeter, Bournemouth, Downsea Valley, and Midlands, East Midlands Airport. That clearly is significant in a number of ways. It fills a little bit of a gap, certainly doesn't go a long way as we would like to fill in the gap left by Monarch, but it does fill a little bit of the way left there. Secondly, we have a geographical distribution of destinations that are now serving the water in package tours, which we have not had before, including Northern Ireland, the north east of England, the southwest of England, the east of England, the Midlands. And that is particularly significant because if there is good demand for those seats from those regional destinations, it may encourage either more classes or may encourage someone to say there is a market there which needs to be exploited and a route which might not otherwise have been available to the user. So that is a very significant development. And the other issue about this particular package, which is significant to the water, is that these are ticket deals to Gibraltar. This is not just an airline filling seat. And many of the people that come on seats, the other members will know, Sandra and Steve is the same. These are charters to Gibraltar on package deals, meaning hotel beds are also going to be used in Gibraltar. So that is significant in those various aspects. We also announced, on the 28th of November, that EasyJet from the end of January of this year, changing the aircraft, the type of aircraft operating between Gibraltar and London Gatwick, and also from Bristol, which will mean that over 3,000 additional seats will be made available in the future, increasing Gatwick availability by 7%,
and the British Airways Liberty by 5%. Again, this does not say what has been left by the unfortunate denial of Monarch, and it is just referring that the Monarch issue had nothing to do with the water. We have had sustained load factors which are significant, and the Monarch, British Airways, and EasyJet. We believe that there is capacity in the market, but as the honourable member may well know, with the knowledge of the airline industry, establishing a new route takes time. And we have engaged, it is precisely as a result of engagement with airlines and with the companies, the tour operators, that we have seen these developments so soon, that the recovery and the increased availability in EasyJet flights. And I want to say, tribute to the work done in this area by the chief executive of the Director Service Board, Nick Gebeda, and also Stuart Simmerson, who works at the DCB, and who specifically concentrates on new development. It is not a new role, it's something that he's had for a long time, but he's particularly concentrating in this area. Now, they are working very hard in contact with airlines, the existing airlines, new airlines. We are making some inroads, but this is a slow process. I do expect, because there is still a demand, and if there is a demand for seats in a particular route, we will see additional aircraft, we will see airlines expressing an interest. But these will take time, of course.
Have the most extensive answer, and of course, nobody is in the party suggesting that the government has any involvement or has in any way affected the outcome with Monarch. That was going to be very unfair. Just regarding the discussion that's now taking place, particularly with the new jet that tends to be obviously that priority of operating to Gibraltar currently. I have good information to suggest that those carriers have snapped up a lot of the slots out of the likes of Luton Airport and Gatwick Airport that belonged to Monarch previously. Therefore, I just wonder if we specifically approach perhaps EasyJet and ask them directly whether or not they would consider just using those slots out of those airports. Luton in particular is currently not being serviced by. And whether they would consider using those slots to provide a developer route directly.
Peter, yes, and not just EasyJet. The other member also mentioned other slots, but Airways have kind of fixed slots from Gatwick. And certainly both EasyJet and British Airways have been engaged, not just generally as we have done with them and with other airlines, but specifically in relation to those issues. And I know that there is probably, as the Chief Minister mentioned, there was a recent report in the Times about this, that there was taking up an extra slot in Gatwick, and certainly we would welcome those increased flights to Gibraltar. There is clearly also the possibility of increasing in number from this fellow company, increasing the number of flights from Easter to Gibraltar, and that is something that we're encouraging them to do as well. So, yes, we are having general conversations with them and other airlines, and specifically as a result of the information we received in relation to the flight.
So I wonder whether the government confirmed whether there's been a discussion with airlines in relation to certain flights to Birmingham. The only reason I say that is been given the clear benefits of linking with Birmingham on the advancing HS2 project, in which Birmingham has really, either there a couple of weeks ago, it's changed phenomenally in terms of inward investment and the clear link between Birmingham and Gibraltar that we could see. I think the government has reached out. And I know the minister said in his answer to the question, was looking at several airlines, but I know that you've delivered 7 by the charter market for the summer that we described before, but whether they are linking up to the state of flights in Birmingham.
Speaking of it, most certainly, Birmingham was a route that was attracted, and it is one of the areas that the government is working on. The honourable member has mentioned the charter flights from East London. It is important, certainly from my point of view, to have a continued schedule of service from the Midlands, as well as from the north and south of England.
Thank you.
Question number 744, the Honourable Ellis Lennon.
Thank you, Speaker. Since the opening of the small boat funding, the Canberra government provides a monthly schedule of personal fees in relation to vessels docking on the power boat berth area, including A, berthing fees charged, and B, berthing fees collected.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation, Singapore.
Speaker, since the opening city of Berlin alongside the Mid Harbour Marina has been charged with the following burden fees. Mr. Speaker, I have a table here which is part of the answer, but rather than reading month by month, I'm actually involved in the I am making a copy of the answer available to the Honourable Members of this so that they can have it at everybody's table. Speaker, can I just add why the schedule is making its way to the Honourable Members? Is that what this shows is that since its opening, we have charged, collected just about all of it, except for the last month, which has been arrears and it still has to come in, but we've charged close to a quarter of a million pounds from Bergen Fees to CPS prior to the establishment of the small business arena.
Question number 745, the Honourable Ellis Young.
Mr. Speaker, is the taxpayer incurring any rental costs for the construction devices used to build a small business arena? No longer in use, if so, can the government provide details?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
Speaker, the government is not incurring any such rental costs.
Question number 746, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Naon.
Has government got plans to build or make provisions for a slipway at the small boat area?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, it is simply not feasible to build a slipway at the small boat area itself. The government does, however, have plans for a service yard for boats at the small boat marina. I would refer the Honourable Member to the answer to question 202 of 2016.
Sorry, Peter, let me come back to question 745. If I may ask the Minister, does the government have any own the device that my Honourable friend referred to, or does it have an interest in that device?
Speaker, that device was actually rented by the constructor. We had JBS who won the tender for the small boat arena. They bought the equipment, actually rented the equipment that was required for that. So the government certainly doesn't have an interest. As far as I'm aware, the government doesn't have an interest in that device that was used.
That's a bit of a system, Speaker. As far as I see, the people who own that device thought that they would wait here until they determined where they would be gainfully employed at next, whether it was here or elsewhere. Should also be in at the crossroads of the Mediterranean and the Atlantic seems in a good place to remain, and there's nothing to be read into that in terms of the volume of the Mediterranean in the cross of the
event. Question number 747, the Honourable Ellis Lennon.
The Federal Government provides daily figures because the average turnaround for parties received from arrival into the boat to delivery of the notification notice of the respective address. Sorry, Mr. Speaker, the noted person was the one who did the Canberra provided daily schedule with average turnaround for letters received from in arrival to the broker. Mm-hmm.
see the kind of damage by the daily schedule, but the average turnaround for letters received from arrival intervals is directly in respect of the day.
Answer the end of the Minister for Commerce. Mr. Speaker, I've pulled off our last question to get a good question 10-8. Question number 748, the Honourable Eric Yammer.
Mr. Speaker, can we go and provide the daily service with the average satellite of parcels received from the voter intervals of two delivery of the materials and places as a respective address?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Commerce. Mr. Speaker, letters, documents, and parcel goods from around the world arrive either by the hubs of Madrid or London. The mail that comes from London is sent to Malaga Airport and arrives at the mail centre by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Monday to Friday. Mail from Madrid arrives midday, Monday to Friday. The daily schedule for letter mail is next day delivery. The daily schedule for parcel mail is 48 hours after arrival, as the registration card had to be produced. Any local letter posted before 7 a.m. is delivered on the same day.
Is the government confident that this time schedule is being adhered to?
Well, Mr. Speaker, we are currently conducting a review. We can do the testing of that to establish how good or bad it has been. Obviously, there are peak periods, particularly in such a powerful Christmas in one of the areas. So we are ensuring we have additional resources to enable meet the demand. And I'm confident that we will. And we will be announcing in the first quarter of next year the results of the review that we're carrying out into the first quarter generally to see how we can use technology to improve and make efficiency of the person so that it can be done.
We now move to question number 759, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, has the MOD handed over to government the slice of the hangar behind the fossil sacrifice on which it is projected to build the college in its store on what day?
I'm sorry, the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir. Speaker, am I going to understand that the site of the college will be purely on the area between the hangar and the current fossil sacrifice, which encompasses the access road to the multi-storey car park? Would that be my understanding?
And I see that the site of the college will not involved using MOD land in terms of its construction, and there is an area of about 1,000 square meters in front of the MOD fence, which is where we're intending to construct the house.
The bigger move of the house is now again until tomorrow at 2:30 in the afternoon.
The House will now adjourn to tomorrow at 2:30 in the afternoon.